This is the first of a series of talks on the history of Darlington to be given by the Reverend Scriven in Darlington, January 1974.
Good attention, folks. The Recreation Council, we welcome you to this series of programs on the history of Darlington. Reverend Mr. George B. Scriven was for many years the pastor of Nativity Episcopal Church, retiring from that post in 1972. He became a resident of Darlington in 1940 when he married Miss Isabel Wilson and has maintained a summer home here ever since. Until recently, he was an editor of religious textbooks, but in recent years, has concentrated on the history of Maryland and the local history of the Darlington community. Articles which he has written has appeared in the Baltimore Sun, the Maryland Historical Magazine, the Church Historical Magazine, the John Hopkins Journal of the History of Medicine. This month he has an article appearing in the Old Mill News on the first mills in Maryland. In making the introduction, I should remind you that on the 21st of January, this room will not be available to us because of the regular meeting of the TCA of this school, and that session will be moved and held in the parish house of the Grace Episcopal Church. I present to you the Reverend Mr. George B. Scriven.
The first thing I have to do is to thank the Community Council for giving me an opportunity do something that I really would like to do anyway, so they just had to give me a chance and I'm here. I'm very much interested in the local history of this area, and about 25 years ago started gathering information on the settlement of the original Baltimore County. That, as you know, was the area on the both sides of the bay. On the eastern shore, the county line went from Colchester into Chestertown. On this side of the bay, the county line was the mountain road going down to Gibson Island. And apart from those two boundaries, nobody knew where any other boundaries of the county were. They were lost somewhere in what's now Delaware or Pennsylvania or Western Maryland. Nobody knew where they were. And when people make estimates, say, of the Indians of Maryland in the 17th century, much the same thing happened. Nobody knew how much country Maryland covered, and nobody had been to all the Indian places anyway, so it was rather hard to tell. One man's guess was about as good as another. In talking about this, I would like to start with a rather broad area and finally get down to a very narrow one of the village of Darlington itself. So, beginning far enough back, discovered that there were Indians here, as there were everywhere else in the United States and South America also, Canada, a great many years ago. There's only been, since carbon dating has been possible, that people have begun to get even approximate dates for such things. And it is estimated that Indians came to this country, that is the United States, to Canada, to South America, at least as early as the Wisconsin glacial period about 35,000 years ago. 5,000 years is important to get that far back. And they came from somewhere from the outer part of Siberia. They crossed the ice into what is now Alaska and worked their way down the valleys of the coastal area and finally went all over this country and all over South America. Now, it's very difficult, if you'll let me get away from the mic for just a moment, to appreciate time. If you let the distance of that board cover the whole 35,000 years that there were probably Indians around in this area as well as others, this little bit from here over begins to cover what we have a little information on. From about here over to about 12,000 B.C., we know that there were Indians in this country, and there's a little bit of information on them, not much. They were at that time wanderers who were not even hunters, they were just gatherers of food. They probably bedded down at night much the same way that most wild animals do, finding as warm a place as possible. They had no tools of any sort. The closest they could get to it was to pick up pieces of stone that approximated the tools that later Indians made out of stone. But beginning about here, about 12,000 B.C., and running from there to about 8,000, I mean 12,000 years ago, to 8,000 years ago, if you go back that far, there was a type of spear point found, which has been found all over the northern part of the United States, over much of the southern one also, and I think down into Central America, I don't know how much beyond that. But certainly over all the area of the United States and up into what is much of Alaska, it was a kind of a point which you've probably never seen. There is one picture there in the most recent issue of the Smithsonian magazine. It was what was called a fluted point. Now they were about the size of this. This is one of them. And on each side, there was a groove, right down, a very noticeable groove down the middle of each side of it. If you ever come across one, you'll be able to recognize it by that. And people began to distinguish them between World War I and World War II. I don't remember the exact time, but the occasion is interesting. A colored cowhand was riding into Folsom, New Mexico, and going down a dry gulch. He came across a place where the bank had slipped down, and he saw something sticking out from the debris. He went over and took some samples out of it, found there was some peculiar-looking spear points among them. So he put them in his pocket. When he got into the local saloon that evening, he was showing them around, and one man saw them and thought that here was something of great importance. So he called a friend of his who was an archaeologist in Indian affairs. He came out and began to work on them, and they, since that time, those they have been called fluted points. There are several varieties of them. They have been found on the surface finds in Harford County, but never in any digging that I know of. I speak with much hesitation on this whole subject of Indian things because the information is changing very rapidly. In any kind of archaeology, a 10-year-old textbook is out of date, and in this one, I suppose a 5-year-old textbook is pretty much out of date. And if you're interested in following it, you ought to join the local society, archaeological society, which I think has its headquarters in Bel Air. I see one of the members in front of me, and if anybody is interested, I'm sure he'd be glad to tell you about it at the time after the meeting. Because if you want to follow the Indian affair, that's the way to do it. But those fluted points have been found in surface finds right here in Maryland. So many of them have been found in Pennsylvania that one Pennsylvania archaeologist claimed that they started this. But the others didn't follow his lead. They said he was not accurate. But we know almost nothing about the Indians of that period, except that they used that kind of a spear point. And just within the last year, some archaeologists found out how exactly in detail how they were fastened onto the spear, and there's an article about it in the most recent Smithsonian magazine. So if you find a relic of that period, it will be one of those fluted points. It's probably fairly good size, and there is a chance of finding them right in your own backyard. The next period is one in which Indians began to shape some stones a little bit to make them more nearly what they wanted. This rather crude-looking object here is one of them. This is a piece of soapstone. This is a part of a soapstone bowl which was broken been processed and manufactured. You can see it was rounded, the bottom was shaped, that was rounded there, and when the maker was trying to dig a sort of a hole in it here, he split off half of it, probably much too disgusting, and he threw it down, and it's been found since. You can find many of those around these parts. Many of them were made on that soapstone ridge near Scarborough, and there's remains of a great many of them around, incompletely made, mostly. But that is a relic of the next period. Then there was, after that, a period which, for want of a better name, they called transitional in this area. Simply, we were moving from one part of a culture to another. And again, about the only thing we know about it very definitely is that Indians at that point started to make some pottery. They started. And having made soapstone bowls, they made a pottery bowl that was shaped something like it, a very crude sort of affair. And those are characteristics of that period. The periods about which we know most were called the Eastern Woodland, three periods within that area. And if all of this represents one of those, this little stripe over here represents about that last hill. And we know more about those because they were the latest Indians in these parts or anywhere else. We know about them through archaeology. The sites can now be located, can be dated fairly accurately, and there still remains a great deal to be done. Beginning with that first woodland period, there was the beginning of some making of pottery. Indians then came to be a little more, by that time, about 200 BC, they began to be a little more like the Indians that were here when the first white people came into the area. They were beginning, by that time, to be gatherers of food, not only gatherers, but to cultivate a little bit of food, not much, but a little bit. And they began to cultivate gardens. They had corn and beans and squash, all of which were varieties that came from Mexico by way of more civilized Indians. And about that time, they began to develop a bow and arrow for use, which is much more useful than a spear. And from then on, we get more accurate information and more of it in the various digs that are made. By the middle woodland period, the bows and arrows were well used. That is, the early Christian centuries would be covered by that. Of course, they had no contact with any civilized part of the world, so all we know of them is through archaeological remains. Finally, in the last of the Eastern Woodland cultures, the Indians looked very much like they did when the white men got here. That is, all those in the East lived in towns. They lived in collections of houses which made up a town or a village. Sometimes they were fortified by having holes placed on end around them, making a kind of a fort. They grew gardens. By the last one of those woodland periods, they made canoes, both dugout and bark canoes. And by the last part of that Eastern Woodland period, they were growing not only gardens, but almost fields of produce. And they weren't depending then as much as they had in the past on simply on getting game for food. Well, that's long enough to spend the few minutes we have on a group of people that really didn't leave us much except the some remains that can be dug up. And if you're interested in it, you can find a lot of information available. And the best way to keep up with it is to join a local archaeological society. It helps the society to do some work, and it gives you some other people to work with if you want to follow up that particular field. And there's still an enormous amount to be done. When the white settlers got here, they found Indians all up and down the coast. And they were in this area of several different sorts. The Indians who dominated this area, when the first white people came to the head of the bay, and before that, they were there 100 years before that, lived in where Washington Borough, Pennsylvania now is. That was their main town. There was a smaller village at the just across the river between the mouth of Oxarara Creek and the dam. And that village lasted there until about 1690. You didn't see why many settlers didn't move into this area until later. Because those were a type of Iroquoian Indians. They had moved down about 100 years before from the Iroquoian area in central New York, where the Five Nations were well known to the first people. And they were chased out by the others. Why, we don't know. Probably because they were outside of the league to begin with, and may have come from in there from somewhere else. But we don't know much, except that one Pennsylvania archaeologist has traced their route down the Susquehanna River, stopping in a variety of places until they finally settled at that Washington Borough area. And there was established there their main village, and which was a fortified one. And they claimed jurisdiction over all of the land down on each side of the bay, about as far as present Annapolis or Kent Island. They didn't live in that area, they simply dominated it and kept other Indians from hunting there as much as they could. But in 1652, they made a treaty with the Maryland colonists, and from that time on, they were more or less friendly, that is, more than other Indians were, to settlers. Then other Indians who wandered through here were Algonquin tribes of several sorts. They came from the present Thistle County area. One group of them came from the present location of downtown Philadelphia, where they had a village, and they used to make raids down on Bush River among some of these first settlers here. There were also displaced Algonquins from a variety of tribes in southern Maryland. And they came just in odd groups, a few here, a few there. They were leaving the southern Maryland, both the eastern and the western shore. They didn't quite know where they were going. They were just trying to stay out of contact as much as possible. They didn't like white people any more than they liked them. And many of them settled just beyond the edge of the colony. We know that from some of the information gathered by some of the ranger groups, that there were many groups of them. Sometimes just a family unit here or there, sometimes 50 or 60 at a time. And they came up being displaced persons. They stayed in this area until all Indians moved on. And they were sometimes a menace to white people, sometimes not. Or you could turn it the other way around and say that the white people were a menace to the Indians. It just depends largely on your point of view, I think. Because they didn't get along very well. The Indians of that period were still Stone Age savages. Their chief delight was in making wars and raids on either other Indians or white people. They would travel long distances to do it. Now, Algonquins from the east made raids as far west as the Black Hills in the Dakotas. Iroquois from New York State made raids as far down in the summertime as the Gulf Coast. And so you see, it was quite easy for the Iroquois from New York to make raids here in Maryland. And they did rather regular. The only thing that kept them back was the Susquehannock Indians along the Susquehanna River, who were squarely in their path, and who were aided by the Maryland colonists in fighting the others. Then, in addition to the Delaware, who came in from the one side, from the Pennsylvania side, the Philadelphia area and Circle County, the displaced Algonquin tribes from southern Maryland, the Susquehannocks, who were already here, there were the Iroquois who raided from New York State. All of them were called Senecas by the early settlers. They didn't distinguish between the tribes at all. They called them all Senecas, whether they were or not, because they were all Algonquins, and to the early settlers, all Indians looked alike. They consistently refused to make any distinction between them. And then last of all, a group of Shawnees came in here. A group of about 100 of them came in. We know that they came from the area of Illinois. They first wandered south in company with a Frenchman, a French trapper who just happened to travel with them. Then they started east. They went down, came down the Potomac Valley. Then they turned north and finally came to the present Harper County area. And when they first showed up, one ranger, or rather one militiaman, with three men went out to investigate this group of 80 or 90 strange Indians. They were pretty hardy in those days. And he made a preliminary report, then another one went out. He took five or six troopers with him, I think, the second time. And he made another report. They seemed to be friendly. And they stayed in this area for several years and then moved over into Thistle County, across on Elk Neck, across about from present-day Charleston. And that area on early maps was called the Shawnee Shore because of the settlement over there. They stayed there for a time until all Indians were driven out approximately around 1700. And actually, it was a little later that they moved out, but that's a good date to hang things on. They and other Indians wandered out into Pennsylvania. Some went north and others simply went west. The Shawnees showed up later on in the Indian Wars in the Kentucky area when that was the frontier. And the Indians had one special thing in this area, which we no longer see, but which was very obvious to the first people who got here. The country was all wooded from here down south. But right over this way, a few miles, beginning at the mouth of Broad Creek, then running up the ridge between Broad Creek and Peddler's Run, and then on a line just north of Dublin, and from there all the way across to the Potomac River, there was a piece of land which was called the Barrens in those days. Mm. It was called the Barrens because when the first white people saw it, it had no timber on it. And it had no timber on it for the simple reason that the Indians burned it off every year. And they burned that enormous area, but they didn't try to put the fire out, they just started it. And the natural boundary where the formation of the land stopped the fires was somewhere in Pennsylvania north of the line, and about this line that I mentioned in our part of this county. A district about 22 miles wide on the Susquehanna River, not quite that wide on the Potomac, and varying in length, of course. If you fly over it, you notice that there is broken land wherever this area of barrens was. It's rough land, not smooth. And just to the south of it, the land levels off a great deal. You can get the sight of that if you drive down the road from Scarborough to 80. If you look on one side toward Pennsylvania, you will see broken land, rather rough. If you look in the other direction, you see it beginning to level off. It's much smoother. And the fires just happened to stop about on that ridge. And the Indians set them again every year. They set fire to the grass and whatever wood they happened to be left. And they kept it in a grassy area because, though they didn't keep stock, that furnished fresh grass every year for the herds of buffalo which were here then, for elk which were bigger animals here and deer, and it provided grazing for the big game animals of that sort. So that they, though they didn't keep stock, they at least fed some of the native stock in that way. And so that made their hunting better. And the Indians were burning off that area as late as 1692. And by 1730, they had moved out of the barrens entirely. And then it was safe for the white people to move in. The first white man to get anywhere near this area was Captain John Smith. He came up in the summer of 1807. On his first trip up, the year that Jamestown was founded, he only got about as far as Baltimore Harbor. The next year when he came up, he made it up as far as the mouth of Deer Creek. And he left a record of his trip in his General History of Virginia and the Summer Isles. Quite a lengthy description of the country, of the Indians whom he found, and so forth. And he discovered the Susquehannock Indians. He discovered some Algonquin tribes on the lower, a little farther down on the eastern shore. And he came across the Senecas who were down here making raids from New York State. He was the first white man in, and he came with a number of companions in a barge which they rowed up from Jamestown. And the second white man to come in came from the opposite direction. He was one of Champlain's voyagers, a man named Etienne Brule, who was one of Champlain's voyagers. And he sent him down one winter to try to recruit the Susquehannocks to fight the Iroquois from this side while he had other Indians working on them from the Canadian side. Only the man didn't succeed in getting them to do anything. As a matter of fact, he himself didn't do his job any too well because he didn't report back to Champlain for 3 or 4 years. And when he did, he didn't give a very accurate report, apparently. And so that some historians have doubted that he ever got here, but I think it's likely that he did, because we know that from his account that he must have spent the winter with the Susquehannocks. It was half a day's canoe trip from their village, their fortified village up where Wrightsville now is, down to the mouth of the Susquehannocks, so that they could come down in canoe in half a day. So I'm sure that if he came all the way down there from Canada, he went down till he touched salt water. He called it till he got to the sea. So he was an excellent, all by himself. Then the traders were coming up. Virginia traders, first of all, came up to the mouth of the bay. All European people who settled anywhere along the East Coast were anxious to get furs. They had a great market for them in Europe. And they were very anxious to get them, and all of the Indians were very anxious to sell them first. In fact, some historians, or archaeologists rather, think that the reason the there is a story that I'm sure you've heard often, which is happened to be completely untrue. I hesitate to mention it because numbers of local historians have written about it, happened. They followed mostly what Prescott wrote in his History of Martha County about the well-known story of the so-called university on Palmer's Island. The more people have told that story, the more they've embellished it and given added details here and there. The truth is that there was an English scholar named Edward Palmer, who was a wealthy Oxford man, who was a director of the Virginia colony, who did have a grant, a Virginia grant, to land at the head of Chesapeake Bay, which Virginia claimed at that time, of course. He got the grant in 1622. He died in 1624 before he ever did anything about it. And the people who report that he started the university on Palmer's Island say that he got there in 1625, the year after he died. But that's the story. So accept it as a nice, fanciful story, and the more the repetitions of it you hear, the more you'll see detail. But the truth is that he never got there, nor did anybody else ever sent by him to get there. And after he died, it was inherited by some, grant was inherited by some relatives, until finally, a little bit later, it wasn't any good because it was, grant was no good because it was in Maryland territory. Traders came at various times from various parts of Virginia. And one Virginia trader, Captain Claiborne, William Claiborne, came up and surveyed the upper part of the bay in 1627. In 1628, he established a trading post on Palmer's Island, now called Watson's Island, at the Imagine Mouth of the Susquehanna. And he maintained that trading post for a number of years. It was a choice position because all the northern Indians could get there. The Susquehannocks got there regularly and they couldn't keep the Iroquois out. So that the Iroquois and furs got down there as well as some Susquehannock furs. And it made a good market. That is, it was good until the Maryland colony, which was started in 1634, didn't like the idea of having a Virginia trader right across the head of the bay. And so, in a few years' time, they had threw Claiborne out off of his claim at Kent Island and out of his outpost here at the head of the bay. The outpost here was finally eliminated by a sergeant of the Maryland militia and a handful of men who came up and closed it out. Since this was an official military operation, it was all reported in triplicate and got into the records in great detail, so that we know exactly what they found when they captured the island. We know, for example, that they ate some of the hogs that were there, and some of the rest they turned loose, which was the beginning of wild hogs in this part of the country. And as you may not know, horses, cattle, and hogs multiplied faster than settlers. Quite a bit faster. So that once the Maryland settlements got started going inland, cattle, hogs went ahead of them, horses. So that when settlement was made up here, they already found wild hogs. They already found wild horses, and there were already wild cattle. Incidentally, in Maryland, they used brands in those days, just like they did in the West at a later time. And just as they did in Wyoming in a later period, they registered their brands at the county courthouse. And you find rather complete records of some counties. Very few records of brands here in Maryland, but I found some. I mean, in Harford County, but what was then this part of Baltimore County. As you know, Baltimore County, being on the frontier, got divided up. By 1674, the eastern part of it was cut off and made into Trissel County. That took off everything on the other side of the bay or the Susquehanna River. And Baltimore County then extended only from the Susquehanna River around about to Gibson Island on this side of the bay. And nobody knew how far back it went. Well, nobody knew how far north, because by 1700, or soon after 1700, the Pennsylvania colony was claiming that the border was in one place and the Maryland colonists claimed another. What actually happened was that the Pennsylvania settlers crowded south of the border in Cecil County, so that the Nottingham locks over here, as you probably know, were originally settled by Pennsylvanians, while Baltimore Countyans went north on this side of the river. And by 1730, Baltimore County extended about up to that Indian fort of the Yonge on this side of the Susquehanna, and that was part of Baltimore County. The first road that came down through here was built to, soon after settlement of this area by a man who ran a ferry up there, one of the early Crescents who got into the news, was the ancestor of the later Crescents of the Frontier Wars. And he laid out a road from his location to Rock Run down Atlantic. And it went right approximately where this building is, right down along to the present village of Arlington and County. Because we know that it went by Rigby House, and it went from there down to Rock Run. So yes, as good as anybody could see exactly where it went within that area. But it went there early. You wonder about the fight between the settlers and the Indians in this area. They were never very serious. They were never, no great number of people were ever involved in it. But just a few. Usually just a handful of people. The first settlers got to the head of the bay in 1658. And probably a dozen or 15 men moved in about that year. At a later time, I talk about the beginning of the plantation, because when they settled up here, the manner of settlement was exactly the same as it was at the mouth of the river. So we'll try to touch on it then. But settlers did come in by 1658. And by 1700, they hadn't yet reached as far north as the present number one route across the county. Not that far up. Queensville was the area of Queensville that still had an Indian raid in 1692, I think, or 1698. And the earliest settlers didn't get beyond Deer Creek until after 1700. Remember that the Indians, though they might have gotten along well with the settlers, were very primitive Stone Age savages. And it was pretty hard for a 17th century settler to get along with them. And just as I imagine they thought the 17th century settlers were pretty hard to get along with. Anyway, they didn't like each other very much. And the friction was never very great, but it was more or less constant. And the settlers, most of them knew nothing about the Indians. They just lumped them all together and looked on them as savages and had as little to do with them as possible. And they were Stone Age savages. The archaeologists, for example, have found up here at Whiteville that within the time when white people knew of the Susquehanna fort up there, they were cannibals. They know that because they found green boats broken and boiled out human bones in their kitchen sheets, rubbish sheets. And the only way you find that is if somebody is eating. So that's the sort of neighbors they had. And so you can understand why they were a little bit squeamish about watching them rather closely. But the Susquehannocks had made a treaty with the settlers, and more or less lived up to it. They tried, and the settlers expected them to. So that when the first settlers moved in along the bayfront and along the Bush River, Gunpowder River, the first question they asked an Indian when they saw him was to try to find out what sort of an Indian he was, because they couldn't tell by his appearance. They didn't know the difference between different tribes. But we have one record which said that when a group of Indians, they happened to be the Ashgaunic Indians or Algonquins, who lived in what's now downtown Philadelphia, and who were came up in canoes. They'd been up Gunpowder River. They got into trouble with several settlers there, and then they next appeared on Bush River, and at the house of Thomas Sampson and another man, two settlers who lived there together, and they saw these Indians coming, and they went out to meet them in their boats, which is a peculiar thing. You wouldn't expect to do it now. You'd expect to meet them on land to fight them. No, they didn't. They were afraid of being cut off in the woods by the Indians, and they always took to their boats first of all when there was a threat of Indians. So they went out in their boats, and some settlers stayed ashore, and then they started to talk to these Indians, and they addressed them, and they, according to the record, they said, "Be ye Susquehannock, answer yea or no." Well, I don't know what they answered, but I suppose the settlers didn't either. Because about that time, some of the Indians had gotten out of the boat and had gone up to the settlers' cabin. And the dog that belonged to one of the settlers jumped one of these Indians and bit him. And the Indian got startled and shot at the dog. And when he started to fire his gun, everybody started to fire him. And the end result was that one settler and five Indians got killed for no good reason at all. The Indians were just on their way out, so then where they wanted to go. But it's just a little illustration of what's happened. That was one of the first conflicts. Soon after that, on another occasion, all of these are recorded in the Maryland archives. We have them recounted in considerable detail, some of these things. On one occasion, here, right in the area, not too far from present Abbey Grace, the Maryland authorities captured the Seneca Indian. To the great delight of the Susquehannock, they wanted to burn him alive. They thought that would be good fun, because the Indians of that day had one way of spending the summer. The women and the children and the old men stayed in the village and grew a crop before the next year and took care of things generally, while the men all went on a spree. They went sometimes thousands of miles as far as they could walk and get back home by winter. And they spent the time murdering and raping. That was their summer sport. Sometimes they took captives. They took women and children captives, very rarely a man, but often women and children. And they did that whether the captives were either white or Indian. And the reason for it was to keep their tribe numbers up in the tribe, because with all of this warfare and fighting, the tribe didn't go very fast, and they adopted people in. And they apparently had no hesitation in taking in any kind of an Indian or even white people, and if they would live with them and making Indians out of it. On another occasion, there were two brothers living about where Joppa now is, who were startled one day. The man was out beating corn, according to the story. That is, he was beating up corn with a needle in a great big piece of a log, which had been hollowed out, with a pestle which was quite heavy. He was out doing that when a couple of Indians surprised him. And they attacked him. So the man's wife promptly rushed out of the house, grabbed up the pestle, and knocked the Indian on the head with it, knocked him out. That stopped the fight. And so she fixed him up and bound up his head, and everybody thought it was all over. Until next day, he came back with some friends, and they started the attack all over again. She came out again to the rescue, and they hit her with a tomahawk that time and killed her. But at last report, she was dying. Now, those Indians were wanderers who had come from southern Maryland, had simply wandered north there was a group of 50 or 60 of them living somewhere on what's now the other side of Baltimore, temporarily. And this one household of them had been living on Back River, where this Phoenix family there was a peculiar military outcome of this. Both a captain and a colonel of militia investigated this incident, and apparently they didn't get along too well because they had a difference of opinion as to whose jurisdiction was involved. The captain claimed that he had a right to take his troop out because these people were in danger, and the colonel said no, he couldn't have taken them out unless he got a direct order from him to take them. So they got into such an argument about it that it finally got down to the authorities down at St. Mary's City, who told them they better resolve their quarrel because if they couldn't get along with each other, they probably couldn't get along with other people either, which quieted them down. But they were reported, and this is of special interest to us, this incident happened on Middle River, and the Indians left there, and they were reported by other Indians who had gone to the mouth of Deer Creek to wait until the bark would heal so that they might build canoes to go and join the Northern Indians. Now, rather odd because the Southern Indians mostly used dugout canoes. In this instance, they evidently knew how to make the bark canoes, and they could make them out of some of the bark, which they didn't have any birch, canoe birch, but they did have, they could make some birch and some bark canoes, and they evidently made them before that last we heard of. There were many such small the people who had the hardest time were a few Quakers on the edge of things who wouldn't fight, and the Indians soon found that out and annoyed them simply by walking through their houses and taking their firearms off the wall and examining the things they had. So just made a general nuisance of themselves, threw their weight around, and knowing that the Quakers wouldn't do anything about it. Now, Maryland at that time had no standing army. It did have a militia. The militia was formed on a county basis. In each county, the government officials at St. Mary's, the governor and the council, chose the colonel of militia and the officers. They were chosen in that way and by appointment. And they, in turn, recruited the rest of the company. And they served on a per diem basis whenever they were called out. It was just a way of making a little extra money when they were called into active service, much like a National Guard thing has been many years since. You know, you get a few days extra pay by going to camp in the summertime for a couple of weeks, something like that. But there were always some, of course, who wanted to do this a little longer time, not just a few weeks. And they were often formed into ranger troops. And there are lots of reports of rangers in this area of ours long before any settlement got north of here. First of all, when the Susquehannock Indians needed some help in fighting the Iroquois, the Maryland authorities sent them a cannon, some powder and shot from Satucha Island, and they carted it overland up to the Susquehannock Fort. They had to go over this area, of course, to do that. There were surveyors over this area by 1683. Though nobody lived here yet, the land there, much of the land as far as Broad Creek or near the edge of Barron's Water, was surveyed by 1700. Then there were various sorts of militiamen who patrolled the edge of civilization. They were called out at various times. There are half a dozen different reports of them, who the commanders were and where they went and so on. And then toward the end of the century, a more regular ranger group was appointed on the northern edge of the county. Their headquarters were in the fort which still exists in suburban Baltimore, a long, low stone building. Still there. That was their main fort. And there was a ranger trail from that fort to the next fort that the Virginia Raider Rangers had about the Falls of Potomac, and the Maryland Rangers had the post on this side of the Falls. And the Maryland Rangers opened up a trail, blazed a trail, and horseback from their fort over to the Potomac, and they kept patrolling that rather regularly. And they laid out another trail from that fort to the Susquehanna, and we know a little bit about that because people like Willie Marie have run down the detail of exactly where the lines have went. We do know that that Ranger Trail was laid out soon after 1692, that it was patrolled pretty regularly by Rangers and Indians, refugees from southern Maryland who were hired to help them, who patrolled with them, who lived in cabins along the route they took. And their object was to keep northern Indians out. There was a great fear then that northern Indians, especially the Iroquois from New York, under French leadership, were going to attack the colonists here in Maryland. They didn't, as you know, for about another 50 years until the time of the French and Indian Wars. The frontier was no longer here. The frontier then was up around Fort Frederick, quite a bit further west, and about 50 years later. And so finally, since there seemed to be no more need for these Rangers, they were disbanded in 1692. There is one record that was left of 1698, that the Rangers were finally disbanded on this northern edge. And they laid out the first road. They had a cabin somewhere not too far from where Dublin is. Nobody knows exactly, but it was somewhere about there. They not only kept their trail open from there to the garrison fort and from there to the river, but they kept several trails open from places along their Ranger Trail down to civilization. It was 16 miles from this outermost post somewhere around Dublin to the nearest settlers down near Bush River. When they laid it out, it was 16 miles down to the nearest settlers. But that, again, is the beginning of some of the roads, and people began to travel those routes. When the settlers came, they came after 1700, and that's what we'll begin with next time. If any of you, time is up, if any of you have questions, I'll be very glad to try to answer them.
This has been Talk One of a four-part series, January 7th, 1975. The next talk will be next Tuesday night, January 14th.
Come there, okay? This speaker last week, I intended to say something about another person who is here. These lectures is really the brainchild of Mrs. Jane Conniff, and she deserves our credit for making almost all arrangements and doing almost all the legwork for it. We have two announcements, lecture. This evening I have a few exhibits that might interest you. First of all, I would like to say that I made one mistake in locating Washington Borough on the wrong side of the river, and my friend here pointed it out to me after the meeting. I didn't know which side it belonged on with a slip of the tongue, but I appreciate being corrected. And I'm quite sure that before we get through, especially in the last two of these talks, I expect to have quite a lot of corrections from the group, because I'm sure that as a whole, you know very much more than I do. This evening, it gives me much pleasure to point out a mistake that my friend John Sowers made. This picture was published in the Aegis last week. I understand he's had a dozen calls about it already. He labeled it Dr. Snodgrass on the main street of Darlings, and it happened to be Dr. Kirk. For those of you who remember him, they didn't look very much alike. Also over here, if you want to see it after the meeting, there's a copy of the first
Deer Creek is 100 tax lists. First one is still in existence. This is for 1737. There may have been some earlier than this, but if there were, they are still no longer in existence as far as anyone knows. This is the first the one. This shows you exactly who was here on this side of Deer Creek in 1737. Here are a few books that might interest you. And over here is a map for Willie Marie's map that he made many years ago of the map up the Susquehanna River from the mouth of the river to the beginning of the boundary. The only way you can appreciate that is to come up and see it in detail afterwards. I think I would like to recapitulate a little bit this evening before going on to a new section. That is to expand a little bit on what was said last time about soldiers and rangers in this area. As you may know, the ordinary officer of the law in colonial Maryland was the local sheriff. But that was only one of his duties, and he didn't have either the time or the men to do any large-scale operations. And so whenever it was necessary, the local militia was called into activity. Maryland had no standing army in the colonial days, but it did have a militia very much like the National Guard of the present time. Its officers were chosen by the governor and his council, and they in turn recruited the members of their troops locally. As some of you may know, government in colonial Maryland originated with the governor. It didn't originate in the people. That came later on. But government at the beginning of the colony originated in the governor, and he and his council made the laws, and he appointed all sorts of people. The only ones who were elected were the members of the assembly, the House of Delegates. They were elected locally, but they were elected when the governor called for an election. In Maryland, the governor called for them quite regularly. In other places, such as South Carolina, I believe they never did call for an election. They never did have an assembly. But here in Maryland, they did meet rather regularly. The sheriff conducted the local elections when the time came for a meeting. And then those people who were elected went down to Annapolis in the latter part of the century, before that to St. Mary's City, to attend the meetings of the legislature. And there was one rather interesting development. In the 17th century in England, the Crown and the House of Lords was losing out in power, and the House of Commons was growing in power. Now here in Maryland, there was a parallel to that in government. As the 17th century grew, the governors and the governor's council had less and less power, and the House of Delegates, which sometimes called itself the House of Commons, incidentally, gained more power during the time. That, as you see, was all leading up to the changes which came at the Revolution, but that's the beginning of it that came in the 17th century. And a part of that governmental control by the governor and his council was in the control of the militia. But again, the militia was not organized to go out on Indian warfare for any extended time. So that from time to time, there were called into active duty troops of rangers, who were usually made up either of whole troops of militia or sometimes pickup groups which hadn't been organized as a group before, but simply consisted of individuals who wanted more extended duty. 81. The Maryland finally decided to organize rangers in every county then in existence. Among those who were captains of rangers here in our part of the county were Captain Richardson and several others. Captain Lightfoot was one. He was also the county surveyor, so he was used to the frontier. He knew where all of the outlying places were because he surveyed most of them. And also, I think, Captain Wells among them. And they all patrolled occasionally up here. When the Susquehannock Indian Fort was destroyed by the Iroquois, just up above here, just above the state line, the colonists were much disturbed, and they sent a Captain Gerard Fly with a troop of rangers from St. Mary's County to patrol the woods around the Susquehannock Fort. That he did the summer that the Susquehannocks were driven out. So that there, all during that century, there was this constant pressure to keep a defense going. Toward the end of the century, in 1692, there was the beginning of a system of ranger forts and trails which crossed the state, running from the Potomac to the Susquehannock. And that trail was patrolled in part on the Potomac end by rangers from a fort at the Falls of the Potomac. About half or two-thirds of it was patrolled by rangers who came from the Garrison Fort, which was built in 1692, but now in suburban Baltimore. The written record, the surety was here, was John West, who lived on Maiden's Mount, which is a grant up here that includes Bald Hill. He was the first settler, and he was there probably by 1722. Also, in that year, John Cooper had settled on Cooper's Creek, which is just on the state line. Cooper's Creek runs into the Susquehannock, and I think part of it is on each side of the state line. That was all part of Baltimore County. Then we know that various people traveled through this area. There were surveyors who got here very early. Thomas Lightfoot, who was at one time a ranger scout, a chief of scouts, was a surveyor who, among other things, never neglected to lay out some new land for himself when he got to these outer edges of things. He owned some land right in this area. And the first grants here were laid out before any people ever got here. The first grants here were surveyed in 1683, and beginning with at Deer Creek, the first one was Mount Geo, Parker's Chance. I see one man here who lives on Parker's Chance. Elberton, Ann's Lot, Phillips Purchase, and Caravan. Those were the grants going north from Deer Creek, and we are just about on the dividing line between Phillips Purchase and Rager Petria, which wasn't surveyed until later on. The line is somewhere down here. It's either, I think, the next piece of property below this includes part of the grant. Then there were other pieces of land near here that were surveyed again before any settlers came in. Bachelor's Good Luck, and Picklemore's Range, and We raised it for 3 years, in Aiden's Mouth in 1719. We're among the early. But not until 1722 are we sure that a regular settler moved in intending to stay. And that was John West, who had owned land on the other side of Deer Creek and probably just moved this much further up with the border. Then a big change came about in about 1730. By that time, things had gotten much more civilized in these parts. The Indians were gone. The last Indians to hunt in the Barrens stopped hunting there in 1730. And from 1730 on, there were no Indians left except those who remnants of people who tried to live more or less like white people and often had great difficulty in doing so. And you find stories here and there about a particular family of them. Sometimes I think the stories are fanciful, sometimes they're probably accurate. But they picture a kind of Indian who was very much different from those who were here in the savage days. Those Indians all moved on. Most of them in this neighborhood moved first into Pennsylvania, and from there they moved into Ohio or Kentucky as the border moved west. But by 1730 they were gone. And instead of Indians hunting in the Barrens, there were land hunters going through there trying to find mineral claims. There were some minerals in that area, not a great deal, but there was some. And there was a supposition that was more because the area was barren. I think perhaps they didn't realize that the real reason why it was barren in those days was that the Indians kept it burned off. I think I mentioned the first time that the Barrens were a big area. They were extended from the Susquehanna River to the Potomac. They were 22 miles wide along the Susquehanna, and the width sometimes got down to about 10 or 12 miles, which was quite variable. And that area was kept burned off by the Indians, brought you down into the Valley of the James. And by 1730, a wave of Germans and Scotch-Irish started down from Lancaster County. Neither group liked civilization too well. Neither group of stuff had done very well in the civilized parts, and so they kept going farther out. And instead of going west, they went south. And beginning about 1730, they followed the limestone valleys down the mountains, and they eventually got down as far as Georgia. Before civilization from the coast got out as far as the mountains. They carried with them two things that became the expression of the American frontier. One was the Lancaster County rifle, which later became misnamed the Kentucky rifle, and the German log house, which they learned to build in Lancaster County. And the log house and the rifle became symbols of the frontier from this area on out. But those people were on the move. They were actually as far as the Valley of Virginia by 1730. And Marylanders were selling land, and Maryland grants were being made along that Indian trail, which later became a road. We can think of one end of it as being where the Susquehanna Indian fort was, and the other end being down in the Valley of Virginia. It's known, the exact route of it is known, and if you're interested, I can find the material for you, the way you can look it up, the exact location. But the Maryland governor made grants of land in that area, some of them near the Susquehanna River, some of them as far west as present Hanover, Pennsylvania. And the first roads between that area and Baltimore County were built by order of the Baltimore County Court. That was still considered in Baltimore County. In both the area where the Susquehanna Court was and the area where Hanover, Pennsylvania was. And the first road to each of them was surveyed by order of the Baltimore County Court. And then a few grants were being made. Their names are known, their locations are known. Some of them, one cluster of them was around where the Susquehanna Court had been. Others of them were scattered along that roadway as far as Hanover. And they were all Maryland grants, and some of them had by the 1730s gotten into private hands of speculators, including Dr. Carroll, who was one of the greatest of the land speculators. And he was selling off land in that area by the 1730s. And one of his agents was one of the men who lived down on Bush River, one of the Westerns, who was his agent. He sold land for 20% of his profit, which wasn't a bad deal for an agent, even an old agent. So that all of this was going on around us. So when that condition had come, then was the time when settlers could come in here in fairly large quantity. The days of danger from Indians were gone. The days when they could get, were difficult to bring in supplies were gone. And plantations could start in a new way. So that around 1730, there was the beginning of a rather large amount of people who moved into this area north of Deerfield. So 1730 is a date to remember, if you remember any of them at all, for this area. The approximate time when settlers began in any quantity north of Deerfield. And in our area, many of them were on Philip Purchase, the Rigby land, and a great many of them on the Arabia Petrea, and all of the larger grants by that time were being subdivided and sold to, in part to other families, not by the original owners. Incidentally, of all of those that I mentioned to you that were first surveyed in 1683 north of Deerfield, only one was settled on by the man for whom the grant was made. For every other one, it was simply land speculation on the frontier. And that was one of the ways in which well-to-do Marylanders increased their wealth. They bought land on the frontier and held it as long as they could, regardless of whatever the laws were. It was to the advantage of the proprietor to have an area settled as soon as possible. It was to the advantage of a landowner to delay the settlement of the area until some other settlers had come in on another piece of land and raised the general value of the land and then to settle. And the Carrolls, especially the Carroll family, were very clever in doing that in Baltimore and Frederick County. I once saw a list of the lands which were surveyed by owned by one of the Carrolls between Baltimore and the loop of the Patapsco River where Ellicott City is. They were very clever. They didn't sell it off in big blocks. They had it surveyed, resurveyed. It had all been separate grants originally. They had it resurveyed into smaller units, and they sold off here, there, spotted all through there. They sold off pieces of it, so that somebody else would settle there when half of the land was settled by people who were scattered all through that area. Then the remaining land, of course, became more valuable. So that's why they sold it off in a pattern like this. You wonder, perhaps, what a plantation looked like and how a man started a plantation in early Maryland. First of all, Maryland was a tobacco colony until about 1800. The Revolution put a bad dent in tobacco production that destroyed the English market for Maryland tobacco. But tobacco was still a major crop until about 1800. It was the major crop. When a man started the plantation, he expected to grow tobacco, and everything else was incidental. And that was true of this area, certainly until the Revolution. The northern area changed more quickly than did some of the rest of it. As you perhaps know, Anne Arundel County still grows tobacco, and it was in the 17th century, still does. But in an area like ours, where there is water power and good land, it is no longer economical to grow tobacco. But that was what the original settlement was for. A man expected to live primarily on the tobacco which he produced. That was just as true of the Whitby family who lived up here on Philip Purchase, in the house that John Clark now owns. Just as true of that family and the others that settled around here that there was anywhere in Southern Maryland. The settlers came in two different styles, sometimes wealthy people and sometimes poor, but not many wealthy. You know, wealthy people don't like the discomforts of frontiers, so you rarely find them. You don't find them there in the numbers on any frontier. You don't find them in the numbers in which you find poor people. And that was true, of course, in the Maryland frontier as it was everywhere else. A few wealthy people came in. Colonel Udy, who paddled to Sousa Island, was the first settler in Baltimore County in 1658. He was a wealthy man. He moved up the river to his place by boat. But whether you were a wealthy man and could have a sloop or a shallop, as he did, and move up in comfort with your family, or were a poor man, you came up in a small boat. And that was the rule until all of the area along the bayfront was settled. Men never came over. They came by boat. And they were so afraid of being cut off by Indians in the forest that if they were attacked by Indians, they took to their boats. The great difference between them and the settlers who began in this area was that the earlier ones on the bay edge, when they settled, had to bring with them enough supplies to last through the winter. And the best time to begin a plantation was in the fall, because a free man could work until fall, work for somebody else, and make some income, and he had to have enough money ahead to buy supplies to last him for a year or more before he could produce anything with any profit at all. And on the bay edge, when he came up, he had to load everything he had into about a 16-foot sailboat and pile it all in there and come up. And then he would identify himself to the nearest official. Then from that he would go and find where his land was and what he was going to do with it. Now when they got here, they came overland from farther down in the county. And they didn't have to bring enough supplies to last all winter because they could go to the bases of supply fairly easily. But apart from that, settlement was just about the same. The first thing a man did when he got to his piece of land was to walk over it, take a good look at it, and find out what sort of land he had, where he was going to locate his house, his tobacco barn, his cooper shop, where he would put these things, and then he would start in, if he began in the fall, as most men did. He would begin then to make a temporary shelter. The temporary shelters were the same everywhere, I guess, and as long as the weather was warm, they could throw a piece of sailcloth over a branch and make a tent. In winter weather, they needed more than that. If they didn't have the house built by the time it got cold, they had to build a dugout shelter in a cliff, or a very typical one was an A-shaped shelter made out of tree branches, shaped like that, covered with dirt, open at one end, and as one traveler described them, about the size of a good doghouse. They actually were exactly the size of, almost exactly the size of a pup tent, and some of you in the Army service of years ago may have slept in those. Possible for two men to sleep in one. Not very comfortably, but it can be done. And that was the first shelter. Usually, a wealthy man brought his family along with enough servants or slaves to work for them and do most of the dirty work. But not many people were wealthy. And the average plantation beginning was made by one or two men who made the venture together on the edge of their two pieces of land, each on the edge of his own land that way. But they could help each other, and it was a lot better, a lot less dangerous than trying to live by yourself. But the great danger, of course, on the frontier was that man might have an accident of some sort. He might make a mistake and break an arm or a leg, or he might hit himself with an axe, something of that sort. And if he was all by himself, he might die before he ever got help. So that it was just safe for two men to make the venture together. And if you look at plantation beginnings, either down on this bay as it first began, or as it got here, you would find they went they usually doubled up, at least two men making the venture together and making their beginning of it. They said the first thing they had to do if they got in the fall, which was the best time to start, was to build a house. There were log houses here at that time. In fact, there were log houses in the Upper Bay Country in the 1600s. That was not known a few years ago when a man named Tredleff first made the discovery that most of the English settlers lived in framed houses, and occasionally one out of brick or stone, but usually framed houses. He got the idea of disproving all of the log house myths which were current, and as most people with an argument of that sort do, he went overboard a little bit. And he forgot that the Swedes from Delaware came over here in large quantities, and they were log house builders. So there are records here in this county of the early settlement of a log house. It was probably done rather quickly and crudely, and not too well done, because the man didn't have much time to get that house built to provide shelter for that first winter. Also, he had to have a supply of dry wood to heat the place. He had to make a beginning of clearing land, and to do that, he chopped down everything small that he could get, reached with an axe, chopped it down and piled it up. And if he couldn't chop down all the big trees to get rid of them, he girdled them to kill the trees, and left them standing and worked around, because the first crops weren't put in with plows, they were put in with hoes by hand. And the man, a settler, brought with him, first of all, the tobacco which he wanted to grow. He brought tobacco to him. That tobacco was usually of a variety called Orinoco. They grew some in Virginia, sweet-scented also, but not up in this county. It grew well over in some places on the eastern shore and some places on the Potomac, but not very well up here. So that probably most of the tobacco here was a variety named Orinoco. You can tell where it came from by its name. So that would be ready for a man to start his seed bed as early as he could in the spring to get his tobacco done. Then he would bring with him also seeds of apple, peach, and pear. And he didn't bring in to eat the fruit, he brought them because apples make cider,
Terry make Terry and teachers make friends. And that's what they use them for. That's why they planted them. The varieties weren't very good to eat anyway, because seedling varieties never are. And those grafted plants were known at that time. It was only after a plantation was well underway that men bothered with grafted varieties of fruit. But at first, their effort was to put in, to get trees of those three things going, to get a tobacco crop going, and to get a subsistence crop of corn, beans, peas, and squash, or pumpkin, and whatever English vegetables you might care for, and they could get to see the most of them here by now. But all of that had to be done, you see, rather quickly in just a short winter. And he also had to have enough land cleared to plant his tobacco crop and these other crops. He had, by the first fall, to build up his cooperage shop to where he could build barrels in order to pack his tobacco in it. And the tobacco at that time was still in fairly small hogsheads. As the century went on, it got into enormous ones, but they were still at the beginning of the 1700s. Tobacco hogshead weighed about 300 pounds. And they packed into it as much as they could in weight because they paid for shipping by space, not by weight. So it was to the advantage of the shipper to cram in as much tobacco as he could in each of these hogsheads. And you wonder perhaps where the tobacco from this area went. We know exactly in one instance because Colonel Rigby bought an acre of land down on the far end of the Lapidum area in order to ship his tobacco from that collection point. You wonder perhaps how it was that some people got wealthy and others remained poor. Generally, although it was a time of depression in the 18th century, sounds familiar, doesn't it? Most of the 18th century was times of depression. And yet, over the period as a whole, the number of wealthy people increased. The number of median income people increased. This is in Baltimore County. And the number of poor people decreased by some 20%. So that, as you see, in spite of the depression, conditions generally were better. The scale used to make those valuations was that a man was counted poor if he had less than 100 pounds sterling in property. He was counted wealthy if he had more than 1,000 pounds, and median was just what was in between. But how was it that some men got rich and others stayed poor? Largely, of course, because of initiative and ability, but there was something in the method involved. No man ever got rich on a tobacco plantation any more than he did on a present-day farm. People have made comfortable livings on tobacco plantations, and they managed in the older areas to build up rather nice plantation houses. But they didn't really become wealthy. Wealth came in other ways. And now, one of the easiest ways in colonial Maryland is to get a job, was to get one of the colonial governmental jobs. In every county, there was a colonel of militia and militia officers who were paid on a per diem basis when they were called into active service. And they were usually like the National Guard. They were called up for a few weeks practice every year. But they got paid for that. And you could do that without giving up time on your plantation. It didn't cost you anything, it was an extra, yes, making that way. A man could also make extra income by holding positions in the county government of various sorts. The office of sheriff provided a very nice living, but of course only one man in the county could have it. And appointments to positions with large incomes were usually given to people who were already wealthy. That was done by the governors on the basis of the fact that a man who already had a lot of property would probably be more concerned with maintaining stable government than the poor one would. Not a bad argument. At least they followed it quite consistently. So that you can pick out the important people in colonial Maryland by the jobs that they held. Now, it isn't necessarily true that if a person is a justice, or the county sheriff, or a member of the assembly, or a member of the National Guard, who is not necessarily a prominent person. In the early days, if he was an officer in any of those things, he was a man of some substance in his neighborhood. And this was additional income for him. And then another great income maker was speculating in land on the frontier. William Marie said from his studies that about half of the people in Maryland, both before and after 1700, about half of the land in Maryland was owned by wealthy Southern Marylanders who held it as speculation. And all of it wasn't held by Southern Maryland by any means. Colonel Thurston, who happened to be one of my wife's more disreputable Quaker ancestors, was one of those who held a lot of land on the frontier. He wasn't a very good Quaker either, because he was a colonel of militia, among other things. But he held a lot of land all over this county, as did Captain Lightfoot, for example, who was a deputy surveyor. Thurston used to go out with him. The two of them scouted the woods together, locating new land. And they both had rather large holdings in acreage. And the effort, of course, always was for such people to get land cheap on the frontier and hold it until settlement moved out and made a demand for it. That was another way of getting rich. And still another way was to start a store and continue it in whatever ability a man had. He could begin with a small local store and could go from that into handling almost anything. He bought at the time. Many men got wealthy on owning stores. Now, if you put all of these together, as some of the people did, it provided quite a large amount of income outside of their plantation. We can again use Colonel Rigby, who lived over here, as an example of that. He was a colonel of militia. That provided per diem pay as a colonel for whatever time he was in active service. He was, at the same time, the county sheriff. That provided enough income for a family to live on quite comfortably. The only drawback being that he had to have a fairly large amount of money because it took money to operate the office. Among other things, he had to gather the taxes in tobacco, and you can't start tobacco around to make change. It should all be done on credit. So that he made income on that. And then he was a land speculator, and apparently he had a store. And he also got in the earliest milling, and that is grain milling and iron mining in the area. So he got into manufacturing, he got into land speculation, he held two prominent jobs in the colonial government, all of which he did in his spare time besides running the plantation. So that was the method by which some people became wealthy. Well, others didn't do so well. Now, we haven't yet got to the village of Darlington. We do know what was the first part of it, and that was the Friends Meeting House, which was built in 1737. Now that was undoubtedly the beginning of the village, although 100 years after that, descriptions spoke of land. One land description that I read described the land as being between the village of Darlington and the French meeting house. The village evidently was the crossroads back this way, and the Quaker meeting house was at the far end. The town, the village, you see, was open land in between the village and the church. But that was at a later time, and that's what we'll look at at some length on our last section. The next time, we will look at the growth of manufacturing. It's rather amazing. It's the thing that surprised me most as I began to look into the background of this area, because it was so surprising. I thought it was all agricultural in background. And here I found that all sorts of industries existed. Fortunately, almost none of them existed, none of the large ones existed within the village of Darlington. Their owners were all considerate and kept the manufacturing out of the village, either on Deer Creek or on the canal on the other side, or on Peddler's Run, but not in Darlington. So Darlington stayed a nice village while the manufacturing went on outside. Remember that the next meeting will take place here in this room, and it will not be changed as we first told you it would be. Now, if there are any questions I can answer, I'd be glad to try to do so. They use horses and they use oxen, both. And I neglected to say that in this area, as in most of Maryland, as the colony expanded from the south up to the north along the bay, on both sides of the bay, horses, cattle, and hogs multiply faster than people did, even faster than the early plantation people did. And they had children in abundance, but not all of them lived. But cattle, horses, and hogs just kept ahead of the population, so that when a man built a plantation in this county, the first thing he had to do before he could have a crop was to fence the cattle out, or they would get in and ruin it, because they were running wild just outside of it. And a determined herd of horses or of cattle or of hogs, knowing that there's corn on the other side of the fence, can do a lot of damage unless your fence is not pretty careful.
I know that they go back a long way, and the reason they did was simply to go back a long way because there's a lot of stones there in the farm field house, and had to get the stone out of them. And one of the ways of getting the stone out was to pile it up on the edge and use it to pile it up on the edge and use it to pile it up. I don't know how far back it goes. I do know that it goes back a long way. And
over on the farm up the farmer's church, because the brothers would call across the hill, take a bar of the yoke of oxen to work from one field to the other, and they used treadmills very extensively at that time for mechanical propulsion.
I think that oxen were used from the very first settlement, though I don't have proof of it in the early days. Benjamin Silver's journal makes a lot of references to them, as you know.
I don't ever remember speaking much fortune, but I know for the sake that they always used to keep borrowing their oxen from one farm to the other. But then,
he was in paradise when he was all
Paul?
Yes.
Did you know that the farm where I live and my father was born is the Paradise Farm?
Yes, I knew that it was on that farm.
And then in 1683, going way, way back.
Yes.
And I think Lightfoot
was
there.
Yes, that was the Thomas Lightfoot, who was the captain of Rangers and the, also the county surveyor.
Now, is Paradise on that map?
Yes, it's on there. Any other questions? For currency, most things were bought and sold on a credit basis in stores as early as I had any records of. And in collecting taxes, it was all done in tobacco. Or rather, it was first done on a matter of credit. They didn't actually move the tobacco from one place to another. They moved the simple things quite credit on the book. And one of the jobs that the sheriff had, of course, was to market all the tobacco, which was the government's share in taxes. He had to see that that was sold. But there was no considerable amount of money here in use until after the colonial period was over. I did a study of the books of the store in 1804, 5, and 6, which was located over between Peddler's Run and Dublin. And at that time, they were still keeping their books in pounds, shillings, and pence, so that was sometime after the Revolution. And they acted as a sort of a bank for the neighborhood. They credited to one person and debited another, so that the person's wages might be paid through the store, the things they would bring in things, particularly the Quaker family named Craig, and known to many of them, of course, and they bought in an awful lot of cheap brandy at that store, I remember. Coinage was still very scarce after the 1800s. American coinage didn't get underway for a long time. They had just fragments of coins of all sorts of European countries. Any other questions? You may have done this to you.
This has been part two of Mr. Scriven's talk on the history of Darlington. This January 14th, 1975. The third part will be next Tuesday night, January 21st, 1975. The third in the four-part series of the history of Darlington presented by Mr. George Scriven, January 21st, 1975.
An announcement to be made tonight so we can go right into our subject. And I can begin by saying that I have about five times as much material on tonight's subject as we could possibly cover. So there are many parts of it where I just have to indicate a little bit and then go on to something else. My subject for this time in general is the industries of this area. I'm quite sure that many of you began, as I did, by thinking of this primarily as farming country. And yet, when you look into the number of industries that have been here over the centuries, their quantity is really amazing. And the one thing that provided the greatest industries all through the whole period, from the beginning up to the present, is the Susquehanna River. At the very beginning, it provided an outlet for furs from the interior that came all the way down from New York State in the Indian days, and were marketed at the head of the bay. As soon as the first settlers got beyond the head of the bay, it provided a way for coming up to get nearer land in these parts, and after with settlements here, a place from which tobacco could be shipped instead of carrying it overland all the way to Bush River, as was done a little farther inland. It was much shorter, you see, to roll the tobacco down to Lapidum than it was to roll it overland all the way to Bush River. So that was the very first industry on the river. It helped the people here by providing income. And the next thing was the beginning of rafting and horse and other such things that carried material down the river from up in Pennsylvania. There doesn't seem to be any exact information on when the first rafts came down the river. My guess would be that they began to come down sometime after about 1740. There were settlers along the river above the Columbia area by about 1730. And certainly by 1740, there must have been plenty of people along the river who wanted some way of getting their produce out. Their only other market was to ship it overland to Philadelphia, but that was a pretty long haul by wagon. And it was much easier to bring it out by water if they could find a way of doing it. And so, at some time or other, we don't know just when, people began to load produce on rafts, timber rafts, and float it out on the spring high water. They found out with practice a little later on that a clever pilot could bring down as many as 3 rafts in 1 year. If he got to know the river well, and if he caught the first flood tide when he should, he could hurry back and he could bring out 3 loads that way in 1 spring. But it was a rough work, and a lot of the rafts were lost. Again, nobody knows. People have made guesses as to the proportion of rafts that were lost in bringing down the river. The estimates varied anywhere from 5 to 50%, so you can see they were all guesses. Nobody kept an accurate count, apparently. But at least we know that a lot of them were lost, because the river had a great many shallows. As you probably know, the worst shallows on the Susquehanna River were in the part that is closest to us. They're from Baldfire Ferry down to the mouth of the river. That was absolutely the worst part to get any kind of a raft or boat over, except on the spring tide, spring current. And then, of course, the water was so rough that things got wet. Passing around there, you will see a picture of a lithograph of a raft coming down the Susquehanna River, which is quite accurate in drawing. It was made about 1830, when they had a great deal of practice in making rafts and bringing down the river. But sometime after about 1740, rafting started, and it kept on in some measure until about 1900. It slacked off rather rapidly shortly before 1900, but there were some rafts in parts of the Susquehanna River after that. But the last one I have any record of that came all the way down the river was in 1892. Now, the early rafts carried out, they weren't interested, they didn't have much of a market for lumber yet. But they had 2 products, farm products, that they wanted to bring down the river. One was corn, and the other was wheat. And they found a clever way of concentrating those two. They concentrated the corn into corn whiskey, and they concentrated the wheat into flour. And that made them much more portable than they had been otherwise. And also, by packing them in barrels, they couldn't be damaged as much. So that was a typical load of the first raft and ark that came down the river. Baltimore got its start just about the time settlers came into this area. And by 1750, it was drawing produce from inland Pennsylvania, much of it coming down the river. Some lumber was sawed in Pennsylvania, but they found that it wasn't practical to bring boards down the river farther than Marietta. And they got further down, they got too much sand and dirt rubbed in them, and the boards were in such filthy condition that they could never scrub them up enough to get them through a planer without ruining the blades, so that they couldn't sell them to mill people, and they had to be sold cheaply as barn boards if they did bring them down. So that is, if they brought them down in rafts. One clever way of bringing out lumber was to build an ark. An ark was a sort of a glorified flatboat with a top on it. It was all built lumber cut in the local sawmills up the river. They were sometimes as much as 90 feet long, about 15 or 20 feet wide. Had no power on them of any course, any sort, but they had a sweep at each end by which they were steered. And they simply depended on the current to sweep them down the river. And they came down usually again on the flood water. There were the many shallow places in the Susquehanna where you just couldn't get anything except a canoe through at any other time of year except the spring. There were, of course, some very large, deep places, but they weren't consistent enough for a person to use them to travel in any kind of a boat for any distance. The Susquehanna River in that followed the description of the Powder River in Wyoming, which was said to be a mile wide and an inch deep. And that was just about the condition that they found here. Whenever they tried to wade it, they found holes that they got into, but they didn't find many places that were clear enough to take a boat across. And one of the few combinations that had both was at Ballfire Fort, which, as you know, is up just beyond the mouth of Broad Creek. And if you look at some of the old maps, you will see that it shows a rock formation going right across the river so that a man, if he could pick his way properly, could wade across it or ride a horse across it. And if he went upstream about 100 yards, he could get a boat across just above that heavy stone that was in there. So that it served as a location for a ford and later for a ferry. The great difficulty, of course, was to get the produce out, and people were looking for a better way of doing it than bringing it down as lumber. Lumber continued to come down in arcs, in rafts, rather. And continued to do so almost until the time that many people here can remember. In fact, some of you here may have seen some lumber rafts on the river. They certainly lasted long enough for those of you who are here to have seen them, if you happened to be there at the right time. And the length that they carried those things was absolutely amazing. There is one record of a man who started from the west branch of the Susquehanna River in the 1880s with a spar raft of timber. And a spar raft was made up of very big logs. The logs were 90 feet long. They were 22 inches across at the small end. And they were 33 inches across, 12 feet from the large end. So that a dozen of them made a pretty good-sized raft. And a typical raft of them was made of a dozen sticks like that. One man would start out from way up in Pennsylvania with one of those, a few people to help him, and bring the thing down on the spring current, and try to sell it at Fort Deposit. They tried to sell smaller rafts further up the river and did, but the very big ones they were trying to take out to a coastal market. And if they didn't get a good market at Port Deposit, they had them towed out into the bay through the C&D Canal, which was then in operation, up the Delaware River to Philadelphia, where they tried to sell it. If they didn't find a good market in Philadelphia, they had it towed across the Raritan Canal, across Jersey into New York Harbor, and they tried to sell it there. And if they didn't get a good market for it there, they had it towed by sea around Cape Cod into Boston. And I have a record of one man who took one raft all that distance in the 1880s. He finally sold it in Boston, apparently at a profit, because he went back and did the same thing over again the next year. And those of you who know something about lumber know the phenomenal amount of feet of lumber that you get in a raft of logs of that size. They were enormous. And those were the big rafts, and they were sold for ship's timber. There was a very great trade for them at the time of the Civil War, but it continued for a long time after. But then men wanted to get other produce out, and they finally built arks, which were barges carrying a pretty good-sized load. They never expected to return them up the river as they did some other kinds of river transport, but they were floated down the river under the power of the current. Many of them were towed from the mouth of the river around to Baltimore by sailboats, and sold in the produce was sold in Baltimore, and the ark was then broken up for lumber, and that lumber was sold there. Now that river made the first big contribution, you see, to our economy by all of that traffic that went along. But it was uncertain, so attempts to start a canal were very early. Some of the people in Pennsylvania fought the creation of canals along the lower Susquehanna, and some of them were in favor of it. They were divided because the people who wanted trade in Philadelphia didn't want to take the trade away from there and have it go to Baltimore. And the other people who had produce to get out wanted to get to the market where they could get the best price, and which meant in part where they could get it to the ship most cheaply. So that finally the canals were built. Many of you have seen a relic of the canals on the other side of the river, from below between the dam and the port deposit. That was the first canal. The people who built it were Baltimore businessmen who financed it. Of course, they didn't do the actual building, and they paid for it and actually lost a lot of money on it, because it wasn't very well planned. It wasn't deep enough, and it wasn't wide enough, and it was too crooked, and it had so many mills on it that they used up a lot of water, so that the total result was that it wasn't very good. And perhaps some of you know where there's a little village named Pilot over in Thistle County. Well, that is very close to the upper end of that canal. And the pilots used to bring the material down the river that far, and they rested up at that village. And then they went back from there. You can take a pilot to take them down through the canal when they could go that way. But that canal only lasted until about 1836. It finally folded entirely after getting worse and worse for some time. And that was the year in which people from Pennsylvania and Maryland got together. They incorporated the new canal in both states. They were quite successful in selling stock in it. And they actually bought out the old canal company and combined the two of them, so that when the trade ceased in the old canal, it was just 1 year before the beginning of the digging of the canal on this side. And the canal on this side went up to Columbia. As you know, Columbia is on the other side of the river. I didn't make a mistake there. They crossed the river on a big dam that they built across, which was a sort of a towpath that got the barges from the other side to the canal on this side. It started out as a 3-foot canal and developed fairly soon into a 6-foot canal. Its locks were 16 and a half feet wide, so that it would take 16-foot canal boats. And it lasted until the time that many of you remember, the same year in which there were such disastrous floods, one named the Johnstown Flood, for example, in Pennsylvania. Now, that same flood did a great deal of damage on this side of the mountain, and it washed out many places in the canal many of them in the this end, lower end of the canal. It said it took 100 men to try to repair the part of the canal just below the bridge, from there down to Haverty Place. Just that part of 100 men working on it trying to repair it. But it had been taken over by the railroad, been not bought but leased by a railroad. And the railroads, soon before the 1890s, had taken most of the trade away from canals. So the canals were no longer profitable. So that the canal ended about then. But while it existed, it produced a great deal of income for people all along it, and not only for all along, but especially in this neighborhood. There were 11 locks in the part between the in the lower end of the river, in the Harford County part of it, which meant that there were 11 lockkeepers with full-time jobs. There was a paymaster with a full-time job. There were all of the people who ran the, took care of the stock and took care of the canal boats and hauled them around and all of that. And then not only did the canal company itself have boats, canal boats, but there were private citizens who had their own canal boat on the that canal. Some of Mr. Silver's relatives, I remember, had one. I think it was Philip Silver. Do you remember who was? Owned one of the boats on that canal. And there were, I think I found evidence of 3 families in Baltimore who owned canal boats that they operated on the canal. So that made another great industry. The canal was a great industry for people all along. And then, even before about the middle of the time of the canal, beginning earlier but lasting late, was the commercial fisheries in the lower end of the river. There were commercial fisheries beginning in the late 18th century, all around the head of the bay and all of the small rivers and the large ones, where the shad and the herring came up to spawn. And they came in such tremendous quantity in those days that people thought they were going to last forever. And they caught them in tremendous quantity. Again, one of the Silver families who lived in this neighborhood was influential in that. That was Benjamin Silver, again an ancestor, I'm sure, this Silver right over here. And one or two others. He got so wealthy on catching fish in the river that he had, I think, 6 or 7 or 8 sons and daughters. And he made so much money in the shad fishing in the river that when those sons and daughters were married, he provided each of them with a large stone house and a going farm, which was rather difficult to get to gather that many farms and stone houses in that day. You couldn't do it on just what you could make on a farm. He made it on fishing. And he was one of the first people to buy a float invented by a Haverty Grace man, which was an improvement in the way of catching. When they caught them from the bank, they could only put out short nets. When they used floats for the fishing, they could, with a boat rowed by with 10 oars by 10 men, they could put out almost a mile of net and haul it up onto this float. And there is a record at least one time of something like 600 barrels of fish that they caught in one haul of one net. And they sold at an incredibly cheap price. They salted them down and sold them that way. And they sold some to local people and some to farmers who came down from Pennsylvania. It was a standard practice for Pennsylvania farmers to come down and spend a couple of days getting drunk here before they went back up with a load of fish. And they brought their salt and their barrels with them, and they loaded the wagon with as full as they could of fresh fish and started back home and left behind them a smelly trail of what they started with the fish as they cleaned them and put them in the barrels of salt.
sort of a den. That lasted for a long time. The peak of the industry was in the about the 1830s, but it actually lasted. There are people who remember wagons like that coming through Darlington as late as 1900. But the industry was mostly gone by that time. There was just a remnant. And as some of you remember, last year it was almost impossible to find any shad in the river. Apparently they overfished so successfully for so many years that they almost ruined the catch entirely. Then the two later great things, great industries along the river were the paper company, which was near the bridge. Many of you remember that, so I won't say much about it, though there's a fair amount of information available. That was a large venture for its day, comparable in size for its day to the power company on the dam at present. Not the same amount of dollars, but for its day, a comparable industry. But the investors lost very heavily in it in a fairly short number of years, and it finally went bankrupt. They were making newsprint, and the bottom dropped out of the market at the same time that the canal broke down, and they could no longer get the cheap transportation of pulpwood from Pennsylvania or supplies from anywhere. And that company finally went out of business. It was succeeded by the power company, and that's the too recent, of course, for us to go into at present. Many of you know pretty much about it. I'm sure many of you remember when it was built. Now, those were the big industries along the river, but they were just a few of them. I'm just going to read you a list here because it's too long to remember by heart of some of the smaller industries that there were in this neighborhood. And as I read this list, remember that each list represents not one particular mill or plant, but simply one location where there may have been many such. In the grist mill, for example, there may have been 10 different people owning a particular grist mill in a particular location over the years that it lasted. There were grist mills, there were sawmills. There was at least one legal distillery in Harford County. I was interested to find that. I knew there were a lot of illegal ones, but I never before found a legal distillery in the county. And there was one. It operated at one of the grist mills, the one marked the Old Mill, which is about a mile and a half below Wilson's Mill, the one that you still see marked on the Martinet map. That, incidentally, was owned by Darlington Man. There was a pretty good-sized iron industry here. There were flint mills and flint kilns. There was a good-sized canning industry. There was at least one talc mine. There were seven or eight tan yards. There were several woolen mills. There was at least one fulling mill. There were several lime kilns. There were at least two bone mills. There was one nursery that I knew of, and at least one talc mine. There were, of course, professional men. We'll touch some of those as we get into the village of Darlington for our next session. But there were quite a number of craftsmen, most of whom operated within the towns or villages, and some few of whom had their plants on their farm. I found one silversmith, one clockmaker, one violin maker, two or three spinning wheel manufacturers, quite a wide variety of blacksmiths and wheelwrights, quite a lot of shoemakers, a number of harness makers, several coopers, one hatter, who also was a member of the Silver family. he flourished at Dublin. There were quite a number of tinsmiths, no, not a great many,
there were more tailors than there were tinsmiths and dressmakers, and there was one man who had an industry of cider making. Now, of those, I thought, since we couldn't possibly look at many of them, I thought it might be of interest to look at one particular mill that I traced a little of the history of, because it is a mill that one which Sam Mason listed as never having been in operating condition. You see, whenever you list something as never having been, it always attracts the interest of people who are working in that field. They think maybe this man was wrong, maybe it did work at some time. So that first attracted me to that. I didn't see how such a remnant as that could never have done anything. So I got interested in tracing it and spent an awful lot of time in doing so. And I'll have to read it because it's quite complicated. But this is the history of it. It's the one which was called a Wallace Mill at one time. It was called a Randall Mill at one time. It was called a Rogers Mill at another time. It was best known probably as a Columbia Mill. I see a man whose grandfather owned the location at one time. And it was in the hands of the location was in hands of many families. I found out where it was, rather by accident, in looking up the beginnings of the Silver family on their land on the other side of Deer Creek, and in looking at the plat of their big piece of land, I saw in one little corner of that, down on Deer Creek, something called 10-acre field divide. And it was right where that mill should have been. It gave me something to follow up. And I found this about it. Incidentally, you'll find the site, the exact location, marked Old Mill on the Martinet map. The 10-acre field was first surveyed in 7.5 acres of 10-acre field divided from not from Bayless, but from his sons after Bayless' death. And what they actually bought was a mill seat location, a sawmill, and a race. Which reminds me that in almost every instance we find that a sawmill existed on a location before a grist mill did, and sometimes it continued along with grist mills at the same location for a very long time. I suppose the reason for that was that they could use the same mill dam, and probably the demand for using the water didn't come at the same time as it did for milling, so that one water supply would run both of them. I don't know who the McCann was who made that beginning. It probably was related to all the McCanns around the Dublin area. But John Rogers was the man who had the farm at outside of Harvard Grace on the hill there, and also was the one who had the well-known Rogers Tavern over on the Cecil County side. Mm-hmm. He didn't actually live at the mill, it was simply an investment for him. And he and McCann didn't get along, and finally they separated. After they had one pair of millstones in operation, in fact they had two in operation, first one set and then two, and they were actually were open for merchant milling in 1779. But they had a dispute, probably because one wasn't there and the other was running it, and Rogers advertised that he would not be responsible for McCann's death. And McCann went on running the mill and evidently got into trouble because he got greatly into debt to a William Smith, a Baltimore merchant, who finally took possession of the mill and counted the debt. And when it went to court, the thing was settled and Rogers was given his just still until he got back to land. The text list of 1783 shows that John Rogers then owned the mill. William Smith had had a great deal of trouble. He was a Baltimore man who financed milling in a variety of places, including this county. And he wrote this complaint once to a friend of his, to a General Williams, who then living in Baltimore. He described an unfortunate connection I formed by entrusting a young man with the management of my mill in Hartford. He robbed me of £500 or £600 and sent 200 or 300 barrels of flour to Philadelphia market, which I pursued and stopped. He sold my stock and did everything in his power to put out of reach all my property in his church. It is probably, I believe, by this connection, nearly £700. £700 in English money was quite a lot in those days. He said, I can bear a pecuniary loss with as much philosophy as most people, but I scarcely remember having met with any that chagrined me more than the present, although I have suffered many of greater magnitude. Finally, when he got the mill back, he sold it to John Stump, who was the wealthy miller of this area. He owned quite a few mills and was said to be extremely wealthy. He got into trouble with the authorities during the Revolution, but they couldn't prove anything on him. In fact, when the troubles were all over, he proved that they were actually looking for another John Stump. At least he proved it to the satisfaction of the court, whether it was true or not. But anyway, he got through it when retained possession of his property. One of my wife's ancestors happened to be a business partner of his in one of those milling ventures. But he apparently didn't want to keep this mill running because he didn't keep it running long. After he'd had only a few years, it was advertised for sale by Randall Wallace. It then had also had a cooper shop and a store. The store was sometimes listed as being in Darlington, but it was also down at that plant. It then had a capacity of 12,000 barrels a year, and the running year was reputedly in most excellent condition. Just a little bit later, Henry Wilson and John Helms advertised the same mill for sale. So apparently, both of these men were simply agents trying to sell it. That was the time when it had a distillery of three stills operating with it. Henry Wilson may, besides being the agent, had actually been operating the mill because he was responsible for building the miller's house there. And he was a reputed owner at one point in a document that I found among the silver papers, an averment made by John Worthington. An averment was something instead of a sworn testimony which was given in court by a Quaker, and it was simply his statement of what he knew about that location. There was a contest. I think Benjamin Silver wanted the land all the way to the stream, and this man said there was a fence there that showed that Silver's land didn't go all the way to the stream, but it was a parcel that belonged to the mill. But he, in the course of that, was described, this was in 1822, Samuel Worthington was described as a near dog. That is the first reference I've been able to find to the name Darlington, 1822. Now, there may have been earlier ones, but that's the first one I've been able to find. I found several of them fairly soon after that, but that's the first reference that I know of. A man named Bailey was at one time the owner for a few years, and Worthington said something of interest about him. He said that when Davy Miller would only run one set of millstones when he was there by himself, and Davy came and once when he ran two pairs of millstones. So that Davy was subject of common sense for two or three weeks at a time at irregular periods at the mill to keep this miller working two pairs of stone instead of one. They incidentally were described at one time in there as having two pairs of French burr stones and one of Cologne stones. What Cologne stone is, I don't know. I suppose it must have been shipped there from Germany. The French birthstone was kept in a place just outside of Paris. And the birthstone was the best quality of stone that the mill could have for grinding flour. Of course, many mills did just by 1800 or thereabouts, did by, got along with millstones made right in Baltimore. There were two firms in Baltimore then making millstones because by 1800, Baltimore was the milling center of the world, the largest flour producer in the world. Of course, it's quite reasonable that there could be two local companies there making millstones. This mill went down and down, apparently passing from one hand to another, and by 1835, it was described as old, and one description of it that appeared in a thing that's known as Mill and Historical Society. And the mill, the last record I have of its transfer was in 1853. It went from the estate of the late Herman Stump to James Forward and John McCoy. Now I know that it transferred several times since then, and it's been in the state of Maryland has owned it for the last 2 years. I think it might be of interest to you to go into a little more detail about what the milling was like. Primitive people in the Stone Age all over the world ground up grain of some sort, either in their crude mortar and pestle or with a round piece of stone which they rolled over the grain over a flat piece of stone. Now you'll find relics of both of those at Indian times in this county. And you can find relics of both of those in many parts of the world if you go back to the late Stone Age period. But beginning at about in the Iron Age and what later became the more civilized parts of Europe, they developed a kind of a hand mill which was made out of two stones about 18 inches across. One of them rode on top of the other in a sort of a hump in the lower stone, kept it in place. And the lower stone was fixed and the upper stone was turned by means of a handle that was stuck into the edge of it, so it turned it like that. You'll find those described in the Old Testament, for example, in the days of Samuel, for example. And the small ones were used by housewives, somewhat larger ones by slaves, and some fairly large ones were turned by prisoners of various sorts. Then from grinding by means of prisoners moving them, the next development was to use animals for turning the millstone, which they simply had a large sweep on the upper stone, larger than the 18-inch stone, and then they simply drove the animals around the circle, and that kept it going. Now, the various sorts of power drift mills are all developments of that primitive hand stone thing, which in English is usually called a quern, because that was the Anglo-Saxon word for it, and that name which was assumed to be used by English people throughout most of Europe. Mills came to be operated both by water power and by wind power in the pre-Christian centuries. And a Roman architect named Vitruvius actually had a very well fulfilled design of a water powered mill in the year 19 BC. So you could see they had developed by that time to the place where architects designed it. Windmills had an almost equally long history, but windmills were never quite as effective as water powered mills, mostly because they had to be small. Now, there were many windmills, wind-powered grist mills in Maryland. The first grist mill in Virginia was wind-powered. The first one in Maryland was wind-powered. The first one in Pennsylvania was wind-powered. And I think that's true probably in many places along the coast or further north. But a windmill was necessarily small. Compared to a water-powered mill. It couldn't turn stones nearly as large. There were two basic types of windmills used here in Maryland, not in this county. I never found any evidence of a windmill in this county, though there's a possibility in one of them that I haven't been able to run down. There was an early mill in the pre-revolutionary on the grant called Pennington Creek down on proving ground, and that is very flat, low-lying land. I don't see how they could get any water power there unless they had a tide mill. And so it's possible that there might have been a wind-powered mill there. But wind-powered mills were generally of two types. The one that was most common was a post mill, in which the whole mill house is set up on top of a post. It sits up about 15 or 20 feet up in the air. And this little mill house sits on top of that, and the steel that touches the air is outside of it. And the whole house turns around by a long sort of a tail consisting of a piece of pine pole that sticks out off of it. And that's moved around one way or another to keep the blade facing into the wind. Now, a more complicated type was the type which is called a cap mill, in which the mill structure itself is very fine, sometimes built out of stone. And just the cap on top turned around, and the pan was put on that so that it could be turned facing into the wind. That could turn larger stones. Now this wind-powered mill is of interest to us for just one thing. It never existed in this county. There were wind-powered mills on the coast of New England, and at the time of the Revolution, salt was a product to very much needed over there. The price of it ran up, and there was a great market for it, and some clever people built salt mills along the New England coast, a lot of them out on Cape Cod. And they simply pumped up brine from the ocean and the flats that they made on the beaches and left the sun evaporate. Now, a clever man in making these brine mills eliminated most of the things that you see on a tower windmill. He just had four posts, and he didn't enclose them anywhere. And he didn't have any machinery in it except a very simple pump. And he didn't have a great big four-bladed fan such as you saw on the old wind-powered grist mill, but it had a very short blade. And that was a brine pump. And a clever mechanic from Connecticut made an improvement on that, by which he made the pump a little more efficient, made the whole structure lighter, and he made a much smaller wheel to catch the wind, which was a familiar rosette of our farm windmill. It was a direct development of the old wind-powered grist mill, and it came to be the farm water pump everywhere around the world. And it's of interest to us because it's a descendant of something that we know about, and something the descendant is going to be something which is widely used here as well as other places. But the grist mill, the water-powered grist mill, it could be much larger. Some of them were small, but it could be larger. and the central part of it was always the Taylor Millstone. Now, there could be many additions to that in an elaborate mill, or a simple mill could have almost nothing else but it. And always the lower stone was firmly fixed, it never moved. And the upper stone turned around, it rode on top of the oven. And the ideal clearance for making flour was that stone should be separated only by thickness of a piece of paper. Wrapping paper in the center and piece of paper at the edge. Now you can imagine how difficult it was to balance that much stone accurately enough so that it didn't rub somewhere around there and getting that clearance. But they succeeded in doing it. And if you look at some of the old mills, you will find that on the floor, near where the millstones were set, with an iron rod that comes up with a bolt on it. And by turning that bolt, that the miller adjusted the separation between the stones. Because the lower stone, the upper stone, rode on the shaft that came up through the center, the lower six stone. Some of the most important millers in Maryland were the Ellicott family, Ellicott City. They used all of the improvements of their day, including many of the inventions of a man named Oliver Evans. And unfortunately, they used his material, his patents, without paying for it, and for many, many years there was a constant set of lawsuits between the Ellicotts of Ellicott City and Oliver Evans about the use of his patent. But he built up the grist mill. He made it what it was by about 1819, and there was no basic change in grist mills from his day on until they went out of existence. And the reason they went out of existence, the reasons were two. And they occurred just before 1890. One of them was the development in this country of a hard northern winter wheat. The Maryland mills and all of the older types of stone mills were made to operate on a soft winter wheat, which was planted in the fall and harvested in the spring. In a country like North Dakota, for example, the wheat would be killed if you planted in the fall, and they'd grow a spring crop, a very hard northern wheat. It's very much harder. It's grown completely in the spring. And it's grown mostly on land, which is used for nothing else. None take a gamble. They go out and plant a crop of wheat and perhaps a square mile or two or three square miles of prairie land. And sometimes they get a crop, maybe 1 year in size, and they get a pretty good crop. But when they do get a crop in it, they'll get enough to buy the whole farm several times over. So that your growing wheat out there has always been a gamble, but a gamble which the person could win if he could keep putting his money back into it often. But that changed in the wheat. The production of an enormous amount of that kind of wheat in the prairie states. And the fact that a Swiss-born Hungarian named Gent invented a tilled field thrower that pressed the grain between the rowers instead of between two pieces of stone was an improvement which was tried by the Washburn Mills in Minneapolis. In the 1880s. It proved to be such an immediate success that except for a few mills which had a local trade in the old style of stone ground wheat, the old-fashioned type of grist mill went off the market in almost no time. The flour from the new mills came in enormous quantity from the prairie states, It could be ground efficiently by the Chill Steel Rollers, and could be sold right here in Maryland at less than price than you could grind local wheat in the water power system. So that was the end of it. But they were here in large quantities, and it's an interesting thing to see how many of them you can locate in this area. I had hoped to cover some other things. I had hoped to say a little bit tonight about one other industry at least, and that is the canning industry. The canning industry goes back to a man in France who, in Napoleon's time, won a prize by a discoverer. Napoleon had offered a prize for some way of preserving food for his troops. This man discovered that if you put meat in a glass bottle, you sealed up the bottle, and then you boiled the thing long enough, the meat wouldn't spoil. And he didn't know why, nor did anybody else at that time know why. They found it was edible. It didn't taste very good, I guess, but it was edible. And very soon that idea was picked up by other people, notably by English and Americans. And by the 1840s, there was a canning industry in Baltimore in which they used tin cans. And the first canning was canning of oysters, of all things that seemed unlikely. And Maryland canned, Baltimore canned oysters were sold all over the country before almost anything else canned was. And then in those days, the early canning was done simply in an open kettle, like a hog boil. A great big thing about so big, made out of iron. And as late as 1890, you could, for $250, buy all of the equipment you needed to start a small canning plant. $250. Seems incredible today when you think about it, but you could buy all the necessary things, and everything was done by hand. But there were continual improvements in canning. The canning industry got away from Baltimore in the 1880s. It started, I think, it was Baker and Abbott Grace, the first man in this county to set up a canning factory. Through Walter Jordan's help, I've been able to locate 18 places so far that I know the canning plants in this general neighborhood. 12 or 13 of them around fairly close to Darlington, and 6 of them about which used Dublin as a post office. I don't know a thing about them except the names of the plants. But in the early days, the process was cheap. It could be run by one family. And they mostly canned tomatoes. There were some fruit was canned in this county at one time, and some beans and corn. But tomato canning was the big industry. And I suppose because it could be started fairly cheaply, a lot of people went into it and got crowded out of it. And I think the Jordan plant is the only one that I know of within a good many miles of here that is still in existence. I think of just what a small amount of equipment it took to start a plant at that time. When they started canning in this country, the tin cans were fairly well made, but they didn't look like ours. They were heavier. The can was heavier, and it had much more tin on it. And the fact that the whole lid was sealed in at the edge, and it just had a hole about 1.5 inches in diameter in the top lid. And it was filled in that hole, and then after it was heated up, a man used a hand thinning iron and put on that little sack that went in there. And that sealed the can. So everything was done by hand in those days, from filling the can to putting on the labels to sealing the can and so on. And I see also we have one man, and I think two in this room, who saw that process go on and go through all of the little things.
This has been the third talk in the series of four by Mr. Scriven, with the last talk being next Tuesday night, January 28, 1975.
The information that you have, write it down about if you happen to be certain of in the village of God. If you live where and when, who did what, in 22 that I can find anyone using the word God. Whereas the word Dublin was used by 1800, and I know who called it that and why. But not to die.
Fourth and last talk of Reverend, this is the fourth and last of the series of talks by Reverend Scriven, The History of Darlington, which was being presented at the Darlington Elementary School during the month of January 1975.
Jane Cartwright, correct a mistake that I made. She wants to share the responsibility for these lectures with some people that she wishes me to acknowledge. I still insist that she spearheaded this. She was the moving force, and she wants to thank Annabelle Birkin, Richard Holloway, Stanford Stanford, and Harvey and Margaret Jordan for assisting her in getting this program organized and all the details of them with it. Now I want to ask a few things of you and say a few things about some of the things that are pending coming out of the Recreation Council.
Is the volume high enough on this? Can you hear me easily in the back of the room?
Good.
A few things to tell you first. This was just brought up to me. That's a sample of the can of tomatoes from the early days. This happens to be a Habitat Grayson, not the local Darlington one, but it's one of the old can labels from the days when they did it in a more primitive way than they do it first. This is a good illustration of the fact that in, as you get into old newspapers, and frequently in the Aegis you find articles of much interest of the past of this neighborhood. This one has the first two articles about the old homes along Deer Creek, and it was written quite a long time ago. Some of the houses are gone, but it makes interesting information about some few of them that are still left. Over here is something that has just been brought up to me to take a look at. This is some of the history of the Canal Company. These are the records of the Canal Company for the last 3 years of its existence, when it just operated in the state of Maryland after 1900. These are the records of the canal boats that went through, what they carried and what they charged for. And over on the board you will see a map. That is the well-known map, Martinet map. If you don't have it, you probably won't want to get it if you're at all interested in the history of the county. That's the 1878 map. You can still buy that reproduction of it. I think you could last year in the courthouse at Bel Air. Can you still get
in
it?
The Treasury's office.
Treasury's office. I remember now I went to the courthouse and tried to get it, and I had to go across the street. But it's a very good reproduction of the old map, and quite worth having if you're interested in what this was like 100 years ago. Because there's a great deal of detail on it, including who owned what houses, as you see listed on the map. Next to it, you will see some excerpts from newspapers and directories about the population of Darlington at various periods in its history. And tonight I thought we might start with what I could find on the very beginning of Darlington. In 1734, the Friends Meeting House, a Friends Meeting House, was built apparently across the road from where the present one stands. And that was the, as far as I know, the first building that within the present area of the village. If anyone has any more information, any better information than that, I'd be glad to have it. As far as I know, that building was the first one. Now, there is a persistent rumor that Colonel Rigby owned a store. I've never seen any actual proof of it. Perhaps in his will there might be. It may be that, mentioned in his will. Might be mentioned somewhere else, but I've never seen any actual proof of it. And if he had a store, it might have been at his mill, it might have been nearer his house, or it might have been here in the present village. You don't know. Some of the people who wrote about the village 100 years or so ago thought that the store was in the village. They thought that it was on the crossroads down here where they're still in the grocery store. I've never been able to run that down. It would take an awfully long time to go back through deeds to run it back. But the information that I have seen so far would indicate that it was not the first. The first use of the name Darlington that I can find, and I have an earlier one than I had last week, was perhaps in 1807 and certainly in 1817. It depends on the exact wording of an account in a Methodist clergyman's notebook, and I haven't seen the original, I've only seen some excerpt from it, so I'm not sure how the original was worded. But from that, I would think it likely that the 1817 reference was to the use of the word Darlington there at that time. The other one may have been predating the area slightly. I don't know. But certainly that takes it back to 1817. The earliest one I had before that was in 1822. In which Samuel Worthington, who was a Quaker and therefore couldn't testify in the usual manner in the court, made an averment concerning the location of a fence on a piece of land on the 10 acres divided plat. And he was listed himself in that as Samuel Worthington, as of near Darlington. That's the first original that I have seen that account before, the use of the word Darlington. Then in 1824, there was one reference in 1824. That occurred in the Bel Air Bond of Union for March 6th, 1824. Mr. William McGilton, who was a shoemaker in Darlington at that time, gave a patent medicine testimonial concerning the beneficial effects of a drugstore item upon the child of his next-door neighbor. And the newspaper was dated 1824. The account was dated 4 years earlier than that. But he is listed as a Darlington in that article. The next year, in 1825, there were several people mentioned as living in Darlington. One of them was a brother of that McGilton, and this one was John F. He advertised his Darlington store in that to the inhabitants of Deer Creek. Said that he had recently opened a store with dry goods and groceries. And he also ran a bi-monthly wagon transportation to Baltimore for the benefit of travelers. Twice a month you could ride his wagon to Baltimore and back. I don't know how long the trip took, but 35 miles is a pretty long day's journey for a wagon if you went all day. Not so bad with a carriage and a team, or not so bad on horseback, but with a wagon, 35 miles is a good distance. And they were about that time hauling groceries. I know as early as 1804 they were hauling groceries from Baltimore up to a store near Dublin. So that the wagon roads were from Baltimore to this area were well used by that time. Also in 1825, William B. Bateman, who at that time was postmaster of Darlington, advertised that he had advertised his store in the paper. Thomas J. Ely was a wagon maker, and he was also an undertaker. And apparently he was an undertaker in this neighborhood from the 1790s to the 1840s, the earliest one. Oddly enough, I've been able to find a continuous record of undertakers up until the last one quit business here a few years ago. But from 1793 on, there were undertakers working here in the village. Mr. James W. Hackett also started a tailoring business in Darlington in 1825. And John Davis opened a saddle and harness shop in Darlington for the next year in 1826. And the Hereford brothers had a store here in 1828. They were succeeded by Edward Markland, who had the store for only a year or two when it burned completely. And after it burned down, Thomas Stump built another store on the same site and leased it to Jeremiah B. Haynes. There were three and perhaps four schools operating in the neighborhood at that time. William Watson, who was the father-in-law of John Ferguson, one of the shoemakers in the village at that time, ran a school in the last house down this way in the via the road, the last house in this road down this way before the streets meet. He had a school there for probably 10 years or so. That was somewhere from about 1828 to 1838, somewhere in there. In 1832, William Waring, who was a Quaker from Thistle County, opened a school in what was called the Old Boston Hill Schoolhouse on the Stafford Road. That was an old log building which he refitted, and it rejoiced in the name. That little one-room log schoolhouse had the name of the Lawnvilla Seminary, rather large name for a small country school. Henry O'Neill was a storekeeper, a hotel keeper in the town at that time, and I have the vaguest idea what building was his hotel. Also, just before the 1830s, Dr. F.K. Coyne advertised a school in Baltimore in which he specialized in Greek and Latin, among other things. You could get a thorough education in Greek and Latin fit to prepare you for the second or third year at Harvard or Princeton in those days. You could get it right here in Darlington. And also there was a school, I can't at the moment think of the man who ran it. It existed for quite a few years in one of the buildings that was down at the far end of the village. The building was a schoolhouse on the farm. It was a chicken house on the farm that's still there. Roy Elliott now owns the place, and he told me that when he used it for a chicken house, it still had the blackboards in it. And that school went back to the early, to about 1830. So before the Darlington Academy ever got underway, there were all of these private schools in the neighborhood. And it's interesting to see that they all tackled the subjects like advanced Greek and Latin. They weren't just concerned with a few elementary things. Samuel Harper was the village blacksmith. Yeah, this is around 1830. The shoemakers were three: William Gilton, John Purveil, and John Ferguson. Land was bought for the Methodist Church across the street in 1832. And services were held either in private houses or in some houses which they apparently rented for some years before that. Because services, they may have held services here, they did have services here as early as 1807. And from that to about 1820. There's a little bit of information about them which was handed to me through the courtesy of one of our members here. And I just saw it today for the first time. It added much to the information which I had about that church. And the Orthodox Friends meeting got started in 1828 on land which they bought from Ephraim Hopkins. The trustees were Samuel Hopkins, Elisha Cook, and Thomas and Samuel Worthington. All familiar names, I'm sure, to most of them. And so far as I can tell, those were the first things that happened around this area when it began to be called Darlington. I haven't yet found any proof of who gave it the name or exactly when it started. Perhaps there is some, but if there is, I haven't been able to come across it yet. There are a few accounts buried away in newspapers that I haven't seen. I know of some that I haven't been able to find that did exist, and I'm still hoping to find a few of them. There is one in existence by a man named Pencil, whose father was the carpenter who did the carpenter work on the Orthodox Friends meeting house when it was built. The Pencil who wrote this article was brought to Darlington when he was 4 or 5 years old. He was not born here. He lived here until he was about 13 or 14, and he went away for 50 years, and he came back for a visit. And he was so taken with it that he wrote two articles about it in the Aegis, which contained quite a lot of information. And some of this that I have here came from his article. I would like very much, if any of you know of any original material, to please let me know about it. I'm quite sure that I haven't by any means found all of it. And also, I'm quite certain that there are many original records of businesses, for example, in this area, which I probably don't even know exist, which somebody has stored away in their home. If you have any such things, please give me a chance to look at it and to see what it is, so I can study it, see if it fits into the history of the era. And you wonder about what happened in all of these various times in between that early one and the present. One way in which I've been able to spot particular occasions is to find in old directories a description of what the village was like in the year that was published. Again, I'm sure there are directories that were published and are probably still in existence that I haven't seen, which would contain something in this area. But the earliest one that I've been able to find so far was published in 1866. And I'll just read briefly what there was here at that time. The stores were run by H.H. Jackson, Hanson and Henson, D.W. Silver, Thomas Ely, who had a furniture store. The blacksmiths were John Andrews, Joshua Garl, Samuel Harper, and Charles Hopkins, who was a wheelwright. There was a tailor named George Groom, William S. Forwood and Ephraim Hopkins and Samuel Ramsey and William S. Ramsey and John Sappington were the doctors in the area. He was well equipped in those days. Five doctors in this immediate neighborhood. There were two hotel keepers here in that town, Thomas Murphy and Thomas Strickland. And there were two tanners in this immediate neighborhood, one at Castleton and one at Berkeley. Bruniger at Castleton and Gideon Smith had a tan yard at Berkeley. And there were, of course, a number of grist mills that you already know about, which were in this area at that time. And in 1871, I found another director. There's quite a lot of change in storekeepers in that town. The stores in 1871 were E.M. Allen and Company, F.W. Komen, B.H. Hanson, John Key, Thomas Craig, Philip Silver, C.M. Warfield, and William H. Wilson, who was a commission merchant. The shoemakers were Samuel Day, Jesse Miller, and John Phillips. The blacksmiths were John Andrews, Samuel Harper, Thomas Ely, and Thomas Massey, who were both wheelwrights. And A.J. Jackson and Company had ironworks of some sort in the neighborhood. There was one baker in the town, Jacob Eberbach. J.R. Hopkins was the butcher. Isaac Battle was the dentist. Joseph R. Ely was the register of wills. Robert Knight was the tailor. Thomas Reed was the telegrapher. The telegraph station was built during the Civil War, incidentally, and lasted here for quite a long time. There was one cooper listed in the town as C.W. Jordan. Carpenters were William Ely, Thomas McNutt, and William Moore. John Kirk was a painter at that time. And the next big list that I have goes to 1878. That was 1871. This is 1878. The stores at that time were H.W. Whitelock and Company, B.H. Hanson, and William Wine, who had a general store. He was a tailor who carried most of the things that went with his trade. Shoemakers were S.S. Day, Jesse Miller, and John Phillips. Harness makers were William E. Chandley. Blacksmiths were Samuel Harper and Joshua Garl, who was a wheelwright, and William B. Self. Joseph Hopkins was still the butcher. Physicians were John Sappington, Jr. and Dr. W. S. Forwood. Carpenters were Thomas McNutt, W. T. Ely, and R. F. McNutt. There was a tinsmith, John Dolman. John G. Dolman, his son, worked with his father at a later time. W.H.H. Whitefoot was the undertaker, and R.S. McNutt was the postmaster. The next directory that I could find was 1895. The stores at that time were E.A. Andrew, Grain and Fertilizers, E.A. Gorrell Hardware, Nard Kemp Drugstore Newspapers, C.W. McNutt Newspaper, Cigars, and Express Agents, W.F. McNutt General Store, C.D. Whitelock General, and William Wine, the tailor, who still had his store. Shoemakers were Samuel Day and Otto Munsey, and William E. Stanley was the harness maker. Blacksmiths were J.S. Garl, H.E. Self, and W.B. Self. S.C. Day was the baker, and John R. Hopkins was still the butcher in the neighborhood. He lasted for a long time in the neighborhood butcher. Dr. C.W. Box was the dentist by that time. Joseph R. Ely was the justice of the peace. W.H.H. Whiteford was the telegraph agent. Physicians were John Sappington and W.B. Kirk. There were more painters, more carpenters by that time. John H. Hughes, John Lamb, R.S. McNutt, S.J. McNutt, Carl Sandiford, and John Kirk was listed as a painter. A.F. Galbraith was principal of the Darlington Academy by that time. Louis McCann came up from Dublin to run a barber shop here. Miss Effie Harper and Miss Lillian Jones were dressmakers. John G. Dolman was tinsmith. Henry Smith was a restaurant. And Joseph T. Warner was listed as a jeweler here that year. Robert Young was a plumber listed that year. The first year I found that a plumber was listed here. And Whiteford was still the undertaker. And J.L. Windoff was a veterinarian. James R. Massey was the postmaster. Now the next one is just after the turn of the century. This was 1906, 1907, back to the time that some of the older ones of you remember. Stores at that time were C.A. Andrew, Grain and Fertilizer, A.G. Chandley Meat Market, W.E. Chandley and Son Harness Makers, W.A. Gorrell General Store, Hopkins Brothers General Store, Fletcher Hopkins General Store, James R. Massey Agricultural Implements, H.P. Self General, W.R. Self Hardware, William Warren General. S.S. Day was still the shoemaker. Blacksmiths were J.S. Garl and H.C. and W.B. Self. John T. James was the baker. Edwin Hopkins was the butcher. The dentists were D.O. Botts and J.C. Botts, I think was the son of the other one. J.R. Ely was still the justice of the peace. And the physicians were Ephraim Hopkins, that's Ephraim Hopkins Jr., and W.B. Kirk. Two painters were listed. Besides John T. Kirk, there were D.C. Garrettson and Son. The town had two barbers at that time, George Chandley and Lewis McCann. Three dressmakers, Miss Effie Harper, Miss Lillian Jones, Mrs. W.J. Scarborough. John G. Dolman was still a tinsmith. Henry Smith ran a restaurant. William H.H. Whiteford added a plumber and steam fitting to his business. He did quite a few things. He started apparently with a store and went to an undertaking business, and he got into plumbing and I don't know what else. He was a sort of a general man, but he was in business here a long time. By that time, a man named Baldwin Baldwin and Bailey were the undertakers and also had furniture. And It was a branch of a bank here then. There was an attorney at law, Joseph Andrew, who owned one of the canning houses. He was a music teacher. That's an odd combination. And also L.C. Forwood and D.H. James were music teachers. And there was a boat builder here, E.A. Gall. I don't know what boats he built in Darlington, but he's so listed. Now, he may, of course, not have operated, not have built boats. That was the town just after the, 2 years after the turn of the century. Now, the greatest problem I've had is to try to sort out which houses still remain in the village were the ones that were here a fairly long time ago. And I'm sure that some of you could give me quite a lot of help in that. Because if you don't know it of yourself, you probably heard some ancestors talk about it. Knowledge about what goes on in a particular neighborhood often remains 100 years or so after it happens in the information of the people who live in the area. They know exactly often what happened in a particular place because they remember their parents saying, perhaps before the days of radio and television, there wasn't so much to listen to, and they heard their parents tell more of the things that went on when they were younger in the neighborhood. So that there was more, I think, passed on by word of mouth at that time than there is in families at the present day. So some information comes that way. Which leads me to a sort of a side issue, but one related to this, and that is the credibility of the evidence that you get. As soon as you start working in history in any area, you have to make judgments about how reliable some testimony is. Somebody makes a statement, you read something in a newspaper, you see an account of it here or there, and you wonder how reliable it was. Well, I think that you ought to begin by being suspicious if you're going to be a good historian. Always be suspicious that it's inaccurate and try to prove it. If you do that, you will often discover something more than existed there in the first place. And be particularly wary of attributing a house to a piece of land at the time someone bought it or it was patented. Because a great many people buy pieces of land without building houses on them. They do it today and they did it earlier years. So that just because somebody bought a piece of land, either large or small, here 100 years ago or 300 years ago, doesn't mean that they lived on it. It simply means that they owned it. And in earlier days, when chances of investment were much fewer than they are at present, and certainly not any more risky than they are at present, but fewer at least, land was one of the choice types of investment. And almost everybody had a little spare money, experimented in owning land. Just as many people still do. Just as I said that, I caught the eye of a man in the back row that I know is doing just that today. I won't say he's in the back row because that might spot him too closely, but he's in the back part of the room. And I know he does just that today. He does just what people, dealers in land, have always tried to do. Find a good piece of land and buy it cheap and hold on to it until it can sell it for a higher price. That's what all of you would like to do. And that has always been part of the business life of this area. It is today, it was right at the very beginning. As I think I pointed out to you, the first 8 or 9 surveys that were made north of Deer Creek, not a single one of the men owned those big grants who had it patented for them, and I don't think that most of them ever saw them. They simply were speculating in land on the frontier. And what you can believe about it is the record of the land transfer, because they're usually quite accurate. There was money involved, and first the court were very careful in making records of that sort. They were not very careful when they transcribed old record books, but when they recorded a piece of land, they were usually accurate. So that's something that you can ordinarily depend on. And you can find a vast amount of local information in the land records about who the persons were and what they did. I think I cited to you the fact that one of my wife's ancestors at one time bought a piece of land between Darlington and the Friends Meeting House. It shows how big Darlington was. It must have meant just around the crossroads up here, and all most of that space in between was vacant because that's where they had the land. They bought the land. So that was in about the 1830s. There was vacant land there. And that tells us that, and it tells us a little detail about some of the people who were there. But be particularly suspicious about dating houses by the time when someone gets title to a piece of land. Also, houses burn often. They burn more often, I guess, before we had fire departments such as we have today. And another person might build a very similar building on exactly the same location. He might even use the same foundation. And 30 or 40 years later, someone coming by might think that was the original house, unless he knew different. So if you're checking back the history of a house, be wary. Don't just take it for granted that that house is the original one in that location. Now, what can we do to spot some of the oldest places that you're most sure of and of the houses here in Darlington? Let's start with the big one at the end, the one that was called the Kirk House for a long time, down back here on the corner. Who knows about when it was built and who owned it and so forth? Anybody have any idea? He had it before Dr. Kirk. Mm-hmm. You know who had it before that?
No.
On the rafter in the house. Mm-hmm. But that was not on the, was that part of the same land originally?
I have no idea.
I think it probably was not, though I don't know. Certainly not. Yeah, that was Philip Silver's house. Apparently that was built for him or bought for him by his father about the time he got married. I used to think it was the house dated to 1800, and I find he didn't get married until about 1830. So I don't think he had the house 30. His father-in-law didn't give it to him 30 years before he got married. Maybe a year, but not 30. So that house would date to him, and probably for certain to 1830 about. That makes a sort of a corner. Does anybody know anything about the stone house across the, diagonally across the road where Bailey had his undertaker's place for so many years? Yes. He had his undertaking business in the same one. Well, do you know who was there before he was? I'd like very much to see it. Let me see it, please. Because often when I get something on one family, it turns up something on several others that were related to me. So I'd like very much to see it, if I might. Then at the far end of the village, there's a house that looks very old. There's a couple there that look very old. Who knows the history of those? I see a man back there who was born in one of them. Johnny, how about the house you were born in?
I was born in Pennsylvania.
You were, yeah. They brought you down there early, though, didn't they?
No, I don't know.
Who?
Eli's Corner.
Who?
Eli's Corner. That's where my district was that you spoke of.
That's where he lived?
That's where he lived, and that was his office.
Because I had him living down here where the store is on the end of this road.
Well, I did in the store building for Walker's store.
Yeah, well, I mean the big house at the other end of the village. It was a Massey house for a long time. Does anybody have any idea how old it was or who first built it? Somebody had told me that that had been a hotel at one time. Have anybody have any idea when the Matthews built that house? How about some of the other older houses here? How about some of the stone houses down this way? People lived there at one time. Who? The present owner was here the other evening. Worthington? Which one of them? Miss Edith Worthington. Is that where she lived? Same house.
That's the building that Taylor Warren lived in.
Yes, he lived in that. And he lived in that at one time. And I think it's the house that Benjamin Silver owned briefly for 3 years before he sold it to somebody around 1840. W-Y-N-D-E.
Oh, thanks.
Yes. Yes. Now, which house was that? Down this way. Well, I think that almost everybody in the county is related to the stump.
Yes.
I'm not sure that all are, but I would say that 90% How about any of the other early houses that you know about?
Old Dr. Brown. I used to still there when the public library was.
Is that the same building?
Same building.
That's where the blacksmith shop was. Dr. Brown.
Yes, that
and the boat building was in there. He saw.
Mm-hmm. And he actually used that building.
Yeah.
Where was the blacksmith part of it?
In the lower end.
In the lower end of it? Covered by the present building?
Yes.
Built both of them. Apparently he did quite a lot of iron work. I had a report from somebody or other that he built the iron part of some of the fountain green pumps that were sold around these parts. The iron fence.
Mm-hmm.
He must have done quite a lot of work of iron work over a long period of time.
Yeah.
And how about the starting where the so-called Mick building was? What was there before it was there? There was a post office. No, the post office moved a great many times, I know, but was it in that building before that was changed? In the center part that has a higher roof?
I don't know what word it is. It's still about 1820, I believe. It's a long time ago we've been part of it. It was in a long cabin from the kitchen.
And the post office was in that middle part with a high center. And what was to the left of it, facing as you face the street from the building? That was on the end that way or this way?
That's an old mound.
No, the bootleggers was drugstore was down here on the corner.
Who was the bootlegger?
Sure.
Daniel?
The same family. So I've heard. I couldn't prove it. That's only hearsay.
You know, some of the Worthingtons were born and raised in our house, by the way.
Yes.
Down on Castleton Road, just north of Route 1.
Mm-hmm.
That house was built about 1820. Just thought I'd mention, it's an old place we live in.
Yes.
You know where we live down there.
Yes.
Matter of fact, it's got inscriptions in the windmill. It says 1830. You know, they put in diamond rings.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that was a log cabin at one time.
But if it was built by 1830, it would be called a log house.
And the big part that's gone now was added maybe 1850.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there were two banks here at different times. I have some record of it.
Property up along the river there. Mm-hmm. Where the old police station was.
It doesn't mention on there anywhere who will redeem the things either. It just says Darlington's Merchants Association or something of the sort. Evidently, the Darlington merchants got these out when times were hard to boost trade. And they didn't use all of them because I've seen several sheets of them that are still in existence that were never torn apart and redeemed. The original grant, the original grant you would find at the Hall of Records in Annapolis.
Not in Bel Air.
Not in Bel Air. All of the colonial records are at the Hall of Records in Annapolis. All land transfers subject to the later than the colonial period are to be found in the county court. Now, the earlier ones, the colonial land transfers, were also done in the county, but the counties no longer have the records of them. The records themselves are in the state. There is a list of, if you give me a call tomorrow morning, I can give you offhand the information on that Paradise Grant. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because I collected the issues of the Maryland Historical Society magazine. About five different issues of it had a list of the rent rolls for 1700, and I bought them and bound them together in one book. So.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, not older than the time when the first known settlers came in. That would be the early 1700s. See, there were no people listed as living on this side of Deer Creek in the in the census of taxables in 1700. That list is complete before Baltimore County, but it's 1,700 lists, nobody north of here. And the next one of those in existence is the one for 1737 that I had up here the other night. And that lists the taxables in the that were north of Deer Creek in that year. And there were 81 going plantations at that time. A total of four about make a population of nearly 500 people. Well, that was very old. That was the purchase made by Charles Carroll of Carrollton, who was speculated on land on the frontier for 50 years, I guess, all over here in Pennsylvania and Western Maryland. And he simply bought up land cheap on the frontier and tried to hold it until the price went up. And he bought up, he patented the Rebus Sequoia. It was patented twice. The first patent was 1721, I think. And it included 4,000 and some acres at that time. But he bought it just on speculation, and he sold it, and it was, when he bought it, it included several older grants. Sycamore's Ridge, for example, is one of the grants included in it. But when he got it, he simply sold it to another man a little bit later, and it was resurveyed. They resurveyed it for almost 1,000 acres more than it had in it the first time. And they got more land in it because one of the boundaries listed in the first survey was the line of the barrens. And try to prove where the line of the barrens. So the second surveyor proved it to his satisfaction, at least, as on the ridge of land, the watershed between Peddler's Run and Broad Creek. The first is the line began at the mouth of Broad Creek, then as it came inland half a mile, it angled up to the top of that ridge. It follows that ridge, and the outer side of it, this side, outer side of Arabia Petrea, and this side of the Barrens, went just about 100 yards north of Dublin. That's one of the few places where I've been able to plot it exactly, because one of the McCausland's who owned that land had a survey made 100 and some years ago, and it lists that crossroad that's presently in Dublin in relation to the line of Arabia Petrea, so that I could get that line quite exactly. The only I can line that had been sold off many times. It was sold in the long about the 1730s. The second owner began cut it up into lots. I have a plat, surveyor's plat, showing the lots that it was cut up into. He numbered them by the letters of the alphabet, and I think it took all the letters except five, so you can guess at how many it was cut up into. And those were sold to different people, and except for one large piece that was held with before a later sale. But I don't mean that people settled on those at that time. I'm sure they didn't. But no, it doesn't show who settled on it. It simply shows who bought what part of it. You can only find out who lived on parts of it often through an incidental reference. So for example, I found a reference to a road which was built in 1751 for the benefit of the people who lived in the Land of Nod, nice little name. That was the land between Winter's Run and Bynum's Run. And for those people who wanted to trade at Lancaster. And they built a road for them, coming off of the road from Churchville to Dublin at Trapp Church. And going past Samuel West's house and then down to Ballfire Ferry, where it crossed the river, and another Pennsylvania road took it on up to Lancaster. But that was in 1751 that people from way down the other side of Bel Air were trading up in Lancashire. And I think that that road was the road that comes from Trap Church up through Darlington. So I don't see how it could be any other way. So it never came up. It may have, but I've never seen it. I've heard that too, but again, I've never seen any proof of it. And I'm afraid that somebody dreamed it up. It appeared in several popular newspaper articles. You know what newspaper people do to make a good story. One of them, Folger McKenzie, wrote an article about Darlington about 20 years ago in the Sun papers, and he mentioned that being on a stagecoach route. But if you stop to think about it, how would a stagecoach from Baltimore to Philadelphia get through Darlington? What would bring it here? The bridges were either above or below, not here. There was as early as 1730, there was a road from Baldfire Ferry, or Baldfire Bridge by that time, into Baltimore, going in through Dublin. And that was in existence that early. And there was another route that came up from Baltimore through Churchville and went over that old bridge that existed at Lapidan for a long time and crossed the river there. Now those were the two routes up this way, and then of course there was the ferry from 1695. There was a ferry at the mouth of the river. But those were the only ways of getting a stagecoach across the Susquehanna River, and this was not on a direct route for any of them. That's why I questioned that ever having been on the stagecoach route. I do know that when they brought the mail here, they brought it up from Place Ford up along Deer Creek up through Glenville and then to Darlington. That occurred in somebody's account of bringing the mail here. So I don't think they would have followed that road if there had been a stagecoach route some other, either a quicker way of information about it. Telling me today there is still a small endowment here given by Thomas King in the days 100 years or so ago when he was around here, which is still used for relief of people in Darlington. I didn't know about it until I heard of it today. Time is up for this evening. I don't mind saying and answering questions if you want to ask them. The time is over. Information. There is bits of information in several books. One Farrington from Kilt to Tog has a little bit about Darlington in it around the 1870s. But that is maybe 25 pages of the book is concerned with Darlington. He lived here about four houses down the street down this way for some years when he was a child. Canceled the Conowingo. That would be the old Conowingo Bridge.
Yeah. You talked about the force of God. I'm sure the people here that
it's very difficult to get references to some of these routes that were minor transportation routes that existed probably only a few years. In one of the issues of a newspaper in the 1880s, advertised that even though their contract for mail was up, they were still going to run a wagon twice a week from here to Havertagrace, for example, and carry freight and passengers. Send me any information you have if you have something you need.
This concludes Reverend Scriven's talk, History of Darlington, January 27th, 1975.